Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's go back to
2009
with Squidge. Let's look at the
Lions Tour
again with Squidge.
Hello, welcome to the Squidge Rugby World Cup Lions Tour retrospective podcast, the podcast that only has one more episode to go until they can just go back to calling it the thing they want to call it that took them 48 episodes to get used to calling it. And then we're lionsed out. And there is today going to rugby.
Rugby, I think.
Okay. Rugby. So I wanted to just establish that very early on. I've been trying to, after last week, for anyone concerned, look at rugby again in the last week, because I had, in that period, forgotten what rugby was almost entirely.
Yeah.
I do want to ask, though, I do want to follow up. I believe you've actually been to rugby in the last week.
I have, you know. Well, I was about to say that on balance, I have looked at no rugby in the last 7 days, other than the one we looked at this game. But I have been through rugby on a train from London, which was going to Crewe.
Nice. Why would anyone go to Crewe? But that's a separate point.
I was changing there.
You were changing in Crewe. You were just taking all your clothes off at Crewe train station, then getting back on the train back to London.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just going to stop
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Look, Crewe changed me. I was a different person. Have you ever heard of a song by Drake called Crewe Love? Because that's actually about Crewe, the train station.
Right.
Yeah.
Did he get changed there as well?
Yeah. He was a changed man as well, and you know, went back to London. Back through rugby, of course.
Yeah.
I was literally sat in a seat on a train, which happened to be in rugby for about 30 seconds.
Oh, okay. I thought you must have changed at rugby, because I knew you were on the train and you texted me to say, hey, I'm currently in rugby. And I thought, that would only be noteworthy if he's not travelling through rugby for 30 seconds.
Well, I just saw a sign in a train station that just said rugby. And naturally, I just thought, what am I going to do here? Well, I might as well just text my brother, who I... like, about 30 to 40% of our discourse is the word rugby.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I just thought, I might as well tell you that I'm currently witnessing a sign that just says it and not referring to the sport.
It's mad, isn't it? Whenever you see something that just... like, whenever you look at a map and you're like, it just says rugby there. Like,
yeah,
you never look at a map
that
and see baseball written down.
Yeah. Like, you know, you look at that map and you just think like, oh, is this, you know, a tribute to Canada flanker Matt Heaton, for example? Like, you know, every player of rugby and coach of rugby,
yes,
everything to do with rugby is encapsulated in that word.
Is. It is absolutely a tribute to former Darlington
particularly Matt Heaton
flanker Matt Heaton, now playing in MLR. It is just a tribute to Matt Heaton and the try score against South Africa. And they saw that in the future and they went, let's name a town after a sport that he might one day play. And therefore then, when they came to invent the sport in the school that at that point was going to just be called Big School, because it was the biggest school in the town, they had to rename the sport from Big to Rugby, which is what they named it entirely, because future Canada flanker, whose father would not be born for another 100 years, was...
I thought that the reason why they stopped calling it Big Cool is because copyright
Big Cool
reasons from Big the Cat.
No, that's what he's called. You said Big Cool rather than Big School.
Big Cool. Yeah.
That's what they call the town.
Big the Cat's surname is Cool.
Yeah.
Like, he's related to, you know, Trey Cool, the drummer from Green Day.
Yes.
And Daddy Cool as well, the Boney M song, you know.
And Ice Lollies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Big Cool, Big the Cat from Sonic the Hedgehog, the franchise, sued Big School in rugby and they changed their name to rugby.
Yeah. But thankfully
history's great.
Thankfully there was a time traveller who really, really loved Canadian rugby, but could only get access to the one game they got battered by South Africa in 2019. So gave a tribute to the one player that scored their one try. That happened to be travelling back when Big the Cat, who was also had ended up back there through the same time travelling antics.
Having been changed in crew, of
course.
Exactly.
He's coming, you know, he's coming from a big of a planet, isn't he? You know, he's just Froggy got lost in time, so we had to go and find him elsewhere. It was a whole kerfuffle. And it eventually led to, in 2009, years later, a game, a match of the sport that was so almost called Big Cool, was instead Big Cool Football, as it would have been known, which sounds like it should be on the PS2.
Yeah.
Instead, a game of Big Cool Football was played between the British and Irish Lions and South Africa. And then another one was played a week after that. And that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, yeah. On the Big Cool Lions Tour retrospective
podcast. Thank you. It is incredibly big and incredibly clever and incredibly, incredibly cool.
So just to fill anybody in, this is one of the most famous games of rugby in history. And we've given you a good history lesson there. You know, people talk about this as one of the greatest games to ever happen. One of the most dramatic, so much to talk about, you know. It's possible that this will be a 2-hour episode like we had before.
It's going to have to be if we're going to cover even the first 10 minutes. So, yeah, so this is, as we say, one of the most acclaimed games of all time. We went over in the previous episode, the first test, which I think is greatly underrated as a game of rugby.
This is
the one where the praises are rightly sung very
much. It was, the first test was a great preface for this, I think, because South Africa dominated the British and Irish Lions for the majority of the match. The Lions fought their way back into it, which I suppose is the bit of hope that the Lions will cling on to throughout the week, you know, is all the pride that goes with it and everything. So, safe to say that both teams are up for this game. South Africa are 1-0 up in the series, but the Lions have it all to play for and have made a load of changes, and they feel and look a lot more ready for this test this week.
Yes, yeah, and that was kind of a lot of the talk in the week was the Lions finished stronger, and so would that, you know, ready them to, obviously, they could start better and then they could still come through better than the tail end. That was a lot of talk in the week. The talk the week following this was very, very different, and we'll get into that. That was far closer to the discourse that followed the 2021 tour, and it was... Can you imagine how nasty the talk after this tour would this game would have been if Twitter... Well, Twitter existed at this point, but it wasn't the same thing.
I was thinking that. Yeah.
After Twitter would have been horrible and so toxic, like beyond what it was this year, if that had been an option, like in 2009.
Yeah. Twitter's reaction to the 2021 Lions Tour, and I covered this on the last episode, has kind of put me off rugby for a little bit. Obviously, I still write about the thing, I still do this podcast, but... I've taken a bit of a step back so I can actually enjoy writing about rugby and talking about rugby and watching rugby when the Northern Hemisphere season comes back, you know, because the discourse around it was so horrible. And like, you know, I wrote an article sticking up for the Springboks and I still have South African fans in my DMs telling me I'm a biased piece of shit. Like, it's ridiculous. So, you know, like, take that up a few notches.
Yeah.
To this tour, because it was so hostile in this tour, and like I can remember listening to Tommy Bode in an interview where basically there was a point 5 minutes into this game where Bod just got them into a huddle and just said, "This is war, okay? Like, we're giving no inch. I don't care how illegal it is. Like, this is war." And we'll come on to exactly why in a minute.
There's a point Dowie Morris makes on. I mean, Dowie Morris, who is perhaps the most baffling of all successful rugby commentators. Right.
Yeah.
Like, there's sometimes you see a current player or a recently retired player work as a pundit and you go, okay, they're not very good at it, but, you know, they're doing it once or twice.
Right? And sometimes you go, at least they're a good player, Shane Williams.
Right. Dowie Morris, who is a much forgotten Welsh qualified English scrum half, and people only talk about him because he was Welsh but chose to play for England instead. That was the only reason anyone remembered him. He instead kind of made a career out of not knowing what was going on the pitch in front of him and being regularly misogynistic. And that was his career. And at one point, with 20 minutes to go in this game, he says, "We're 20 minutes away from the Lions definitely winning this test match. It doesn't get much better than that. I've got the best seat in the house. He then says that Brian O'Driscoll's just made a tackle he's been penalised for. He said it doesn't matter that it was illegal, it was worth making. The Lions are better off than South Africa for Bod having made that tackle, despite him being penalised for it and injuring himself in the process.
Yeah, yeah. On balance, I would describe that as not worth it.
There was a moment in which I wondered, is that the worst bit of punditry of all time?
It's up there. I mean, if you put aside Dowie Morris's misogynistic comments, which technically count as punditry, given he's doing it on telly on a rugby game, I think if you put them to a side, you have a case.
Yes, Dowie Morris, a baffling individual. But that's the point you're making, just like of Brian O'Driscoll was willing to make an illegal shot there, you know? And a little bit of it is you've got in their heads a bit. And both teams were completely flying at each other. There's sometimes so many. Can you imagine how many cards would have been dossed out these days if they were given?
Like, oh, I did think this.
Nailed on red card for Matthew Rees at one point.
We'll
get onto the nailed on red cards that should have happened in the first minute.
Yeah. There's one that where Brian Habana flies into Tommy Bowe.
And
it was a perfect textbook shot at this point. Whereas now that would be looked at and would maybe be a yellow card, you know?
It's very similar to the one Ruth Corabetti was sent off for against France.
Yeah, yeah. It's not too similar,
is it? It's very similar to that, but there's actually slightly more contact to the head.
Yeah.
But as you say, like, it's a great tackle.
Perfectly great tackle back then. Yeah.
So, should we look at the teams for this particularly, I believe they say, Titanic encounter?
Yeah. Let's start with the box.
The Springboks team. So the Springboks go with largely the same team they did the previous week. They make one change to the starting 15 with Schalkberger returning from injury to win his 50th cap. This should be a great occasion for him, one that he's going to really be motivated to have a really positive game and a really positive day.
Right from the first minute, you'd imagine, that he's going to have a really positive 80 minutes right from the off. Yeah. So as you say, largely the same team. So Heinrich Brosseau, as you say, is on the bench. Chili Boy Ralapele comes onto the bench.
And doesn't come on.
And is unused.
Presumably because he's just kind of swaying from all the heroin he's taken an hour earlier.
Sure. I'm sure maybe he's passing on some advice for Matt Stevens to go on tour in 4 years' time.
Yeah, on the next tour. He's South African as well, so.
Yeah, of course. Should we go swiftly on to the Lions? I think the South African team mostly speaks for itself. It's a brilliant team. You've got Dupria, Habana, de Villiers, Schmidt and Duplessis in the front row. It's a brilliant team.
They stick with A.D. Jacobs and Jean de Villiers in the centres. Jean de Villiers has not had this best run of form, but is Jean de Villiers, who obviously stays in.
Sure, he's a Titanic man.
Jacques Free and Morningstein are very much kind of the form players in South Africa as bats go, coming into this and they're put on the bench. And they kind of stick with the more established players in the midfield because both of them are quite... Well, Morningstein certainly is only his second cap. Ricky January drops out the team, unfortunately, which is a huge shame for fans of dive passes everywhere. Though there is a treat coming up in the second half. The Lions, make more changes from the first game. So there's a couple that are injury enforced. So Lee Byrne got injured in that first game, and in comes Rob Carney for him.
Not a bad replacement.
No. And again, you know, we'll come on to that, but... They then drop out Phil Vickery, who had, as we discussed at length, a nightmare in that previous game.
Bless him.
They drop Ugo Monya, who failed to finish a couple of times and got a lot of stick for it. In comes Luke Fitzgerald. Yeah. And Matthew Rees comes in for Lee Mears, who got called up for the Crisp convention a day earlier and can't even make the bench.
Obviously, Ewan Murray couldn't play on Sundays because of his faith, whereas Lee Mears couldn't play on days of Crisp conventions because of his occupation.
Yeah. He had to go and sell some golden wheels to people.
Yeah, yeah. Was he cited as well for his many crisp sales that he'd made?
No, he actually wasn't. Peter de Villiers commented on that in the week and said, this is rugby. If you want to go and do crisp sales, go to the dress shop, buy some nice tutus and sell some crisps.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, it was a really weird comment that made absolutely no sense in or out of context.
Yeah.
The Lions have Ross Ford and Harry Adds on the bench, but don't bring either of them on.
Yeah. So Shane Williams is on the bench, O'Gara stays on the bench, Alwyn Jones moves to the bench with Simon Shaw taking his place in the starting 15, and Andrew Sheridan also on the bench, is solid as a rock.
Buried the lead there. Simon Shaw becomes the oldest man to ever make his test debut for the Lions at 35 years of age. Simon Shaw, who, since playing on the 1997 tour, where he didn't make the tests, going on the 2001 tour, where he didn't make the, 2005 tour, he didn't make the tests. In the middle somewhere, he went to the beach that made you old, and he came out the other end as a greying, kind of like He played like the guy in the thirds who used to be really good but is slowing down a bit.
Sure.
But, like, you know, he kind of had that energy to him, but he, like, elder statesman, you know.
Yeah.
He came
at Lions level.
Yes. The Lions brought him in, and boy, was that an inspired decision.
Yeah. It's talking about him and Carney, it's just like, substitutions that aged well.
Yes. And I reckon at the time, bringing in Simon Shaw was probably quite a bold thing to do.
He played
well off the bench against the emerging Springboks in the week, the test match, the game between these two first and second tests.
Yeah.
And they kind of went, okay, there's something we can do there. So they started him.
On paper, Shaw and O'Connell isn't the most dynamic second row partnership, but they're both tremendously talented and hard bastards, which is exactly what you need against Matfield and Botha, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, as you say, an inspired decision. And Alan Wynne-Jones moving onto the bench, I think, was a good call, you know?
Yeah.
At this point, he really worked as an impact sub. I think, you know, he does play well when he comes on.
Yes. So, I suppose we'll come back to Simon Shaw as we go on through the game.
Yeah.
Or do you want to start on Simon Shaw?
No, not Simon Shaw, but there's one more selection that is worth talking about, and that is the referee.
Yes!
So, last week's Dick of the Day, unanimous, Christoph Burdos, who was the previous TMO and was asked to referee this game. It's his first major test match, so he hasn't refereed a Tri-Nations or a Six Nations match yet.
I can tell you, actually, he had refereed one Six Nations game. He refereed Ireland v Scotland the previous year.
Okay.
That was his only Tier 1 match. He refereed two Tier 2 matches. Yeah. Prior to that, he'd refereed a handful of games between the Pacific Nations. His first test was between Samoa and Tonga. He'd also refereed Samoa against Fiji and Tonga against Fiji. So he'd done some games in that Pacific Nations Cup. He then
great prep for the Lions Test Series.
World Cup warm-up game between New Zealand and Canada. He was a touch
These
judge.
These are quite
the
sparse.
He then refereed a game between the Barbarians and South Africa at Twickenham the year before this, as well as a Six Nations game between Ireland and Scotland, which was the only Tier 1 v Tier 1 game he'd refereed prior to this.
Wow.
He is listed on the official Rugby World Cup website as being 0 centimetres tall and weighing 0 inches. Sorry, weighing 0 inches.
So he's like only just bigger than Hamish Watson?
According to South Africans, yeah. So no wonder you kind of didn't notice him when it came to making decisions.
Yeah. So as you said, some great prep for refereeing the Lions Test Decider, maybe the most pressurised rugby match in 2 years of Test Rugby, well, 4 years of Test Rugby, I suppose, either side of the World Cup. So, interesting decision.
I'm going to tell you something more about Christoph Burdos.
Go on.
Christoph Burdos, and I've just read this, started refereeing in 1986.
What?
Christoph Burdos started refereeing in 1986.
So 23 years into his career.
23 years into his career, he got a test match for the first time.
He is just by complete fluke, is given the biggest rugby match ever.
Okay, but then the French Rugby Union have a rule that once a referee turns 45, they've since got rid of this rule, once a referee turns 45, he can no longer officiate at the top level. So he was dropped as a referee a year after this, so he didn't make the following World Cup.
I thought you were going to say it's one of those laws that, like, in France, if you're a referee and you turn over 45, you know, it's legally okay to shoot him with a bow and arrow in a field or something like that. I thought you were going to spout a law like that, which, to be honest, if Christoph Burdos was in charge, probably would exist.
Once the referee hits 45, they must carry a bottle of wine and a shotgun with them to every match. So Christoph Burdos, right, referee for 20-odd years, got up to test standard, then was dropped about 18 months later. Well, you say got up to test standard, we'll, you know, talk about that. Got up to test standard, then was dropped by the French rugby due to, like, an official rule that made no sense almost immediately.
I've just checked. So Wayne Barnes is probably the most experienced referee on the circuit now. He's 42 years old. Currently in 2021. And also, I mean, it's one thing to discuss his refereeing credentials on. He's a really good looking bloke. That's just come to mind.
Wayne Barnes.
Wayne Barnes is a good looking guy.
Wayne
at
Barnes
42.
Has that, like, Hollywood. You know that thing when you see Hollywood actors in their 40s and you go, like, well, okay, no, it makes sense because they've got access to the best skincare people in the world, right?
Hmm.
Wayne Barnes has got that, but he's a barrister who referees rugby.
Sure, yeah. I mean, like, I get that he's not quite as good looking as maybe Steve Walsh, for example. But, you know, we can't set our barriers too high.
Should we do a separate podcast on hot referees?
Yes, let's do it.
The Steve Walsh podcast on... So, Burdos is appointed to referee the game. He has, I suppose, spent some time looking over his French-English dictionary since the previous week. But there's still a lot of errors.
We'll get on to that. Yes. We'll get on to that. So let's talk about the kickoff. Usually we'd probably jump to about 5 minutes into the game, but the Lions kick the ball off. South Africa set a maul after catching it, and they go forwards a bit. And you think, okay, this is going to be a game here. And then Foroy Dupree kicks to touch, and you think, okay, Lions attacking opportunity. Let's go. Let's see what's happening here. And suddenly Christophe Bell's caught up in conversation. What happens, Robbie?
Yes. So I assume you also were very much looking out for this, knowing it happened in the first minute.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went back.
I remember this clear as day from watching it in 2009.
Yeah, same.
And I'm sure everybody listening knows what we're on about.
So after the maul, one of the South African players carries in, and over the top steps Luke Fitzgerald, who is, you know, when that way happens, like a back will step over the breakdown, they'll be very easily blown out and they stand to the side.
So,
right?
When the maul was happening, I spent my whole time watching Luke Fitzgerald stood on the left wing and seeing when he would get involved.
So he's barely involved in the ruck, right? He's kind of, he steps in, he kind of thinks about going for a jackal, realises he's a winger, moves along. You know, he kind of forces the opposition to commit a man to the breakdown, that's it. Mm-hmm. Schalk Burger is lying on the floor, having been part of the maul. He spots Fitzgerald and he lunges for his head, right?
Yeah.
He grabs him and then shoves his fingers in his eye and is very clearly looking at him, looking at what he's doing and digging them in. He's digging his fingers into Fitzgerald's eyes.
And so the worst thing about it, so originally he kind of crot rolls Fitzgerald, right? And then gets him into a position where he has access to Fitzgerald's face, right? One of his hands he notices isn't going to quite make it, and so he digs in with his other hand, and it's really horrific viewing.
It's horrible, and he is like, he is looking at him, he knows exactly what he's doing, he can see where his fingers are going, and as you say, like, he brings his eyes round, his fingers round to go into Fitzgerald's.
I honestly gasped, and like, I was looking out for it on first viewing, I couldn't watch it back on the second. And just to reiterate, this happened 19 seconds into the game,
into his 50th cap. One of the biggest games he'll ever play, other than that World Cup final. Right?
Yeah.
Berger goes for the most... Genuinely, it's the most blatant gouge I've ever seen on a rugby pitch.
It's one of the most abhorrent things I've seen in a sporting arena.
It's... And, like, I have heard all kinds of reports from people that know him personally that Schalk Burger is a lovely man and is a very warm and kind man. And I believe
my
that
God.
Completely, right?
Respect him. Yeah. I think he's an incredibly amazing rugby player, and I don't doubt that he's a great guy as well, you know? And as I say, I've not let this taint my view on Schalk Burger as a person, a player, anything like that. You know, I still respect him immensely. But looking at this one isolated incident, it's abhorrent.
Anyone who does that, right, there is at least a bit of their soul that is the soul of a cunt. And, you know, and that comes out to the fore there, right?
Yeah.
Because you know, I just know like that is something that would never occur to me to do.
Sure.
You know, and that's not.
And you are
a
cunt as well.
I was going to say, like, look, like 80% of my soul is the soul of a cunt, and I just lent 20% to Schalk Burger, who is otherwise a lovely man. As I said, I'm assured. And I think it's very much that, like, if you're brought up as a Springbok and you're wanting to be a Springbok, you're kind of forced to be incredibly confrontational and angry all the time.
You are.
And I often think
that's always been their way, you know?
Yeah.
And that's great. It works so well for them.
I often think this about, like, rugby players in general, that they're taught really unhealthy ways of managing their anger and emotions.
The
fact that they're led to, like, just be angry all the time and let it out every now and again.
And if you're not angry, you're taught to be arrogant, you know?
And I
like,
think
if you're a fly half or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's a particular problem in South Africa. Like, I think that's an even bigger thing because of the brand around the Springboks and because of how the Springboks are held and the way they're looked at and, you know, what's valued there. And I think that's a different and bigger point, but it's something.
Aggression is heroism in the Springboks, so it should be because that's what.
No, and I get it. Like, it's not a but you end up with this kind of situation where something boils over every now and again. And it is, like, as I say, it's not a judgment on Schalk Burger at all, but it is a cunt's trick.
No, indeed, the Springboks. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Exactly.
It is horrible.
So,
It is the clearest red card, and it should have been like a very lengthy ban. Like, I would have said 2-year ban, right? If I were looking at that.
Obviously, rugby has this whole thing about trying to protect its image by claiming that everybody's remorseful and giving people really short bans. But I think, depending on the behaviour of Berger following the ban, I think you start at 2 years and you maybe work down or up from there.
Yeah.
You know, given it's an assault and it's a very bad one at that. And it sounds a lot like sour grapes here. But if this was a Lions player, believe me, I'd be saying the exact same thing.
Yeah, yeah, no, I completely agree. Like, I wouldn't want the player that did that on the team. You know, I would hold it against them for the rest of their career.
Exactly.
I don't hold it against Schottberger necessarily, but it's a, you know. Do you remember, have you checked how long he was banned for?
From memory, it was around 10 weeks.
8 weeks.
Which Eight he weeks. Only sat out six of, I believe. So he came back from his ban a couple of weeks early, didn't he?
Yes, I remember. Like, he came back. He like played without, the Rugby Championship that year.
Without even an appeal or anything. Like, he just came back and World Rugby did nothing about it, right?
Yeah, so he came back and played in the Rugby Championship later that year. Played in the Tri Nations later that year. There was a further investigation. They said that it was no intention to gouge Fitzgerald's eyes, but Berger acted contrary to good sportsmanship by making contact with the face in the eye area.
So, like, oh, he didn't gouge him, but he did. He did oppose rugby values by gouging him.
I love that they cite rugby values as the reason for not gouging someone.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, reason for ban. You'd think the reason for banning him is obvious, you know, that he committed a very dangerous act on a rugby field. Like, it's like, no. Nothing to do with that. That's fine. He opposed our values, man.
Rugby has a rule that is ungentlemanly conduct. Someone can be red carded for ungentlemanly conduct.
Rugby is so like, far up its own arse.
Like, if you don't raise your little finger when drinking a cup of tea, you know, if you don't bow or curtsy properly to the Queen when she's, you know, to like Princess Anne when she's shaking everyone's hands before a match at Murrayfield, you can be red carded for it. Berger responded by saying, "I only have the utmost respect for the wonderful traditions of the wonderful game of rugby. Through my life and career, I have always approached the game with the intention of only ever playing it hard and fair. I am not a rugby thug and will never intentionally engage in eye gouging or similar illegal actions."
Right, okay, like, I believe that that's true, everything Berger says of himself. Yeah. But is that a fake showbiz quote?
I don't know. That is his actual quote attributed to him by the South African, you know, by Sport24, the South African.
Full rugby values there.
Yep. He says, you know, he also says, like, as a proud South African and Springbok rugby player, I have only the utmost. I am therefore grateful the judicial officer confirmed my stance for his conclusions that there was no deliberate eye gouging to be charged, blah, 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 blah. I apologise to my supporters and fellow teammates for the fact that I've been absent for the first 10 minutes of the second test. I look forward to returning with zest in due course.
You know what else is funny about that, right? So Berger will have pleaded guilty to reduce his ban, right? Because the way it works in rugby is...
He pleaded not guilty.
Did he now? Okay.
The charge was of gouging, and he pleaded that he didn't eye gouge, he just made contact with the eye. Right.
Okay.
And he's found
so he gouged.
Yes.
I'm struggling to see the difference. He opposed rugby values rather than gouging. Yes. There we go.
Yes, absolutely.
He opposed rugby values via Luke Fitzgerald's corneas.
Rugby values.
So let's.
But you know when you were on that train, right? How many values did you feel in those 30 seconds flashing through your body? Did you just feel so virtuous?
There was a lot of big, cool values. I will tell you that. So there's a hell of a lot to unpack here, right?
Yes.
So. The conversation that happens between Christoph Berdos and his touch judge.
This is the thing we've lost in the middle.
So, which touch judge is it? It's not Bryce Lawrence. It's the one on the other side, isn't it?
I thought it was Bryce Lawrence.
In fact, you know, you're right. It's Christoph Berdos and Bryce Lawrence, who was last week's referee. Who, as we established on last week's pod, has lost all respect for Christoph Berdos because of his poor communication as a TMO. So. He communicates with Bryce Lawrence. Bryce Lawrence is the one who spotted Berger do this on the floor. And fair play as well to Bryce Lawrence for spotting this. We've covered it in a lot of times before that he is not the best friend of Springbok fans. But Bryce Lawrence spots this immediately and calls off over Berdos and says, look, this is a really serious incident. Number six has gouged on the floor. It's very clear that his finger goes in the eyes. You need to do something about this. And Christoph Berdos goes, What?
Yeah, he begins to walk back, going like, what a great time we're all having.
He's like, okay, as a family, thanks for letting me know, man.
Yeah.
Have a great day. Keep on.
And then he steps, then Lauren steps back in and goes, no, you need to do something about it. And he goes, oh, it's a yellow card. Goes, it's at least
yellow
a yellow card.
Card.
It's about to, and he's like, he cuts him off mid-sentence, wanders back, says, your finger go near a yellow card. Send him off. And no, I forgot. I meant to get up the clip as well, actually. Because I'm pretty sure he says something mad again as he's sending him off.
Yeah, so he kind of panics and goes, yellow card. And then Bryce Lawrence kind of sarcastically goes, I think it's at least a yellow card.
Yeah.
At which point, Birdos then goes, yellow card! And calls over Bird, like, Berger.
You watch Lawrence as he's walking back. Like, Lawrence is starting to talk again as Birdos walks back to give the yellow card.
That's the thing. So Lawrence clearly has a moment where he goes, I should have set my authority a bit there. I should have said a bit clearer that that's a red. And, like, right. I had it in my head that it was the touch judge's fault for saying at least a yellow card. Right, yeah. Which, don't get me wrong, it is. But Bryce Lawrence should have communicated, instead of phrasing it as at least a yellow card, he should have phrased it as, I think that's a red card, mate. Yeah. Like, he should have phrased it that way. He should have used the word red. Right.
He was trying to be witty, wasn't he? He was like, I've got Mr. Bean in front of me. I want to be a comedic genius as well.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to be
Black
Adder.
And Christoph Berdos interpreted that very badly. And obviously, having the context of the previous week and the communication language barrier between those two, it kind of contextualizes this a little bit and makes you realize how Berdos interpreted that instruction from his touch judge, right?
Yes. Yes. So he, I say, calls Berger over, gives him a yellow card. We are 40 seconds
can't
into
speak.
The game. Yes, and we all can't speak. And Berdos also brings up the original penalty was going to be against the Lions. And mentions he reversed it for the, you know. And that's the thing he talks about more than the fact
that is.
You have completely contravened rugby values and therefore going to prison.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man. So there's another point slightly later on where I have in my notes, Berdos is useless. So there's a bit of a sort of scuffle 5 minutes into the game, which I think is the one Tommy Bowe was referring to when he said Brian O'Driscoll called his men in. So Brian O'Driscoll is kind of pushed after the whistle.
Yes.
Not long. It's one of those things that happens all the time. It's Victor Matfield pushes him. O'Driscoll, being the most insanely talented rugby player that exists, starts a fight in the most, like, show-offy way possible by backdoor reverse flicking the ball into Matfield's head. He does miss, mind you, but Matfield gets what's going on. There's a massive push and shove.
Meanwhile, whilst O'Driscoll's throwing that, Mike Phillips, being one of the most insanely talented fighters with McDonald's bouncers has ever been, walks over and shoves Victor Matfield because that's his way of doing things.
Yeah, yeah. The thing that Mike Phillips as a scrum half was best at throwing was a tantrum, right?
Yeah.
So Mike Phillips really, you know, goes for Matfield and tries to get in his head and everything, not realising Victor Matfield is hard as nails. But anyway, so that all happens. It's one of these things. It's one of the highest intensity rugby matches you will ever see. And the players walk away from each other. Berdos goes over to Bryce Lawrence and asks, hey, what's gone on? Lawrence goes, don't worry, mate. Like, these things happen. Rugby incident. It's a push and a shove. Just don't do anything. Just sort of give them a warning. And Berdos goes, oh, okay, penalty. And Lawrence goes, no. No need for a penalty. Just give them a warning. You know, just sort of tell them off, say no more of that, and get on with it. And Berdos then calls over both captains, as well as O'Driscoll and Matfield, and says, you start, you restart, it's a penalty. And but both of the captains then kind of just look at each other like, what's this guy on about? The penalty's given despite Lawrence advising not doing so. It's a bizarre moment of miscommunication.
So, yeah, so Brian O'Driscoll is essentially penalised for pushing someone in the, being pushed in the back.
Yeah.
So I've got here with me the conversation that Berdos has with the captains and the referee.
Okay.
So, with the captains and O'Driscoll and...
first player in we've spoken to, in 7 green as well.
Okay.
Doesn't sound like there's going to be a bit.
13 and 7.
7 green is Ryan Smith, of course. Here he comes.
13 green.
Well, he came in for a bit of afters. Brian O'Driscoll, as you say, was not going to take a step back there. Victor Matfield, the ball.
After, both, little fight. you start, and you restart. But the first is you. First penalty against you.
We're no chance this side.
I love the look on the captain's faces when they're just like, what do you mean by that?
First is you, but also is you. Little fight, stop, penalty.
This is where you need like one of those reaction gifs when someone's just won a rap battle. I'm just like, he's been told there, mate.
Little fight, stop. Really good decision by IRB to appoint Christoph Berdoss for this game.
Yeah,
So we move along. The Lions are playing a lot of rugby in this opening 10 minutes.
Oh boy, they start this test match as well as anybody could. Like,
yeah.
This is as good a first 10 minutes as you'll see from any team in a test match of this quality. Like, speaking of good appointments, Rob Kearney, man.
Yes!
Like, literally 5 minutes in, I went, he's an improvement on Lee Byrne. And there was another 75 minutes of him being world class.
I think this is the best game Rob Kearney ever plays in his life.
I wouldn't disagree with that.
I think there's another player on this field who also has the best game they've ever played in their life, and we'll get to that as we go on.
Sure, yeah.
But I think this is the best Rob Kearney ever, ever plays. He is unbelievably great.
Yeah.
Every high ball he takes seemingly is under enormous pressure, and he literally catches every single one. He doesn't knock on a single ball, not a single handling error, despite the amount he had to take.
He's towering over JP Peterson, who is like one of the greatest chasing wingers you will ever see. And he's also like hard as nails. Like, he is an unbelievably tough winger. And he is constantly just leaping above him and nicking the ball when he has absolutely no right to. So there's one where he, at the start, where Kearney catches the ball under pressure, spins out of contact, doesn't call the mark because he spots that he just has to beat one defender, snakes through the South African defence, and then they set up this break that Tommy Bowe makes eventually. He offloads to Gethin Jenkins, who has the ball in space, which I imagine made you explode. And I was hoping he'd do a chip and chase, but instead, he sells Francois Steyn with a dummy, attempts to offload, and it goes about 20 metres forward. But, you know, great moment of glory for Gethin regardless, getting the ball in space. It was a lot of fun, but my God, Rob Kearney's good.
And yeah, Gethin very almost gets that right. He very, very, he comes as close as any prop could have. Most props would have just barreled through.
He looked comfortable. You know,
panicked. Like,
eventually he did make a mistake, but he looked comfortable getting the ball in space. Tommy Bowe is bloody good.
Because when Bowe makes that break, you think, oh no, he's only got prop in support. Then you remember it's Gethin Jenkins.
Yeah,
and you think anything could happen here. As you say, he could snap drop goal it. But instead, we get that break. As I said, Tommy Bowe has a like perfect game. There is no more anyone could have done from his position in every scenario he's in.
He was constantly dealt really uncomfortable situations and just making breaks off them, like or making good tackles and stuff.
Brian Habana has a very similar situation. Habana is consistently given the ball too late or too early. And there's nothing
or in
on
no space,
consistently.
You know?
Exactly.
Always
he's consistently given the ball when there was space when the ball first came out of the ruck, but it's closed down by the time he gets there. And he's always making ground and making space and finding
something. Remembers Brian Habana as this like speedster who would just score tries from 90 yards, which he was. But he was so solid. Like, he would always make right decisions. He was a great passer of the ball. He would chase kicks fantastically. Never made mistakes in defence. Like, he's just one of the... Is it weird to call him underrated when people call him one of the greatest wingers of all time?
I don't think it is, but Brian Habana was fundamentally a nuts and bolts winger, you know?
Yeah, right?
But he
who happened
so
to be faster
fast,
than a cheetah.
Yes, that he kind of elevated everything he did.
Mm,
That he was at heart like a Gonzalo Camacho, Josh Adams type winger but who...
He grew up as a scrum half. It's easy to forget that, you know? He grew up as a scrum half, so like his understanding of, you know, all situations on a rugby field are generally very good, but stuck to his thing of being a good winger.
Yeah.
I could wax lyrical about Brian Habana all day.
Yes. Yeah, it's very, very easy to. And I think we've probably been fairly Lions-type biased so far.
Sure, I recognise that.
It's nice to have a little go. But the Lions continue to build and build and build, and after a few fights, you know, it's sort of the Lions doing nice attack and then having a fight, and then the Lions doing nice attack and having a fight.
Yeah.
First 10 minutes. And they've won, and it's not the most promising attack they've had so far. But Simon Shaw makes a brilliant carry that really gets them like quick over the gain line.
Mm.
They use the quick ball. Stephen Jones throws this phenomenal offload.
Roberts makes a great carry as well
in
the lead up.
And Rob Carney said since that he had no idea that ball was coming out by Stephen Jones. He wasn't expecting it at all. And he then kind of like bats it back into from one hand into the other and starts going.
So what's brilliant about this offload by Stephen Jones, so it's one-handed out the right hand. And you rarely see Stephen Jones throwing those offloads, you know? And he manages to perfectly throw it as hard as he can so it goes quickly enough that it doesn't end up in the hands of Fabana. And as low enough so it just evades the left hand of Fabana and lands perfectly into Rob Carney's mitts. And like as we've already touched upon, like Rob Carney's hands are just completely impeccable. And you say he just jets off at this point.
Yeah. So it's, again, just like perfectly executed by Carney. He goes, he drifts so far back in field, if you watch from the other angle, that he turns it into a 2-on-1 when actually there's really no space there. Franz Steen then, once again, confuses Carney for Geoffrey Jenkins, drifts off him, and he's kind of like, Stuart Barnes says in commentary, he's wanting Carney to throw the pass to Beau. He doesn't throw it. Carney goes himself. JP Peterson gets across, makes actually a really, really good cover tackle, but can't get under the ball. Carney grounds it, finishes it. The Lions go 8-0 up. Stephen Jones kicks the conversion from the touchline. 10-0 up.
Yeah. Yeah. As I say, it's as good a first 10 minutes as you'll see. Like, and it's perfection from everyone involved, from Roberts to Stephen Jones to Carney to even Beau. Like, it's perfection from the Lions there. Yeah.
I did watch those kind of first 5 minutes, and at 5:30, I jotted this down, that a modern team would put 6 tries past South Africa by now.
I know what you mean. Their
defence spaces out very unevenly.
We are 45 minutes into this episode, and we have covered the first 6.5 minutes.
Yes, but we'll speed up from here.
Yeah.
So, yes, the Lions then continue largely as they are for a bit, and the Lions, again, feel completely on top. But South Africa keep just having odd moments.
Yeah, so there's one particular swinging moment, I think, where the Lions have a massive overlap and Geoffrey Jenkins doesn't pass the ball out the back and goes himself, gets done for holding on, John Smith turns him over. South Africa kick into the corner. Duplessis. South Africa kick to the corner and come up with a great line-out move. So... Go on.
So they go straight off the top. The Lions are expecting a maul. They're very much crowded in around that. Victor Matfield also does this kind of like fake out thing. That means that when Foy Dupree does come round, David Wallace at the tail, stood in as the first tackle on the inside of the 10, is drawn straight in by him. Luke Fitzgerald does not come up properly. Leaves a huge hole open for JP Peterson to go right through. And obviously he's close enough to the try line. He can run round Ron Carney the long way and then take it in next to the post and make the conversion very, very easy for Ruan Pienaar.
Yeah, Kikuchi for his quality, you know.
Yeah, he's absolutely nailing that. You can then see, I don't know if you noticed this, did you keep an eye on Stephen Jones as the try is scored?
Nope.
Stephen Jones starts absolutely bollocking Luke Fitzgerald.
Really?
Like, Stephen Jones is furious with him. Like, before the try is scored, he sees him go through and he turns to Fitzgerald and he starts shouting something and he starts pointing to where he should have been. And then, like, he leaves it for a second, then goes back and turns back to Fitzgerald and points again. He's like, no, you really should have been here. And, you know, Stephen Jones was not a man who was easily flustered. You know, he's a very calm, composed. That was the whole thing. Yeah. He was a very calm, composed man. And, you know, still very much is as a coach. He was furious with Fitzgerald. It was clearly like a defensive misread by him. Like, he should have been in that hole.
Evidently, the Springboks did their homework brilliantly and clearly thought that's a space that would open up. And Foy Dupree is exactly the scrum half you want executing that move, you know? Like, the way that he holds the ball to the very last second. And Peterson's line is exquisite, man. Mm. Like, if you give Peterson a one-on-one with the fullback and that much space to just beat him to the corner... Yeah. It's a done deal, you know?
Around this time as well, I'm not sure if it's just before or just after, I think it's just before, there is an unbelievable cross kick by Foy Dupree.
Yes! So off the outside of his boot.
Foy Dupree goes for a cross kick off the outside of his boot, right? As if anyone listening to this has ever tried to kick a rugby ball, you, like, almost, like... 99% of kicks, right? Probably higher, 99.99999%, everything excluding this one kick and the one by Juan Martin Hernandez. Most kicks off the outside of the boot are mistakes. Like, you're not aiming to hit that. Because it's almost impossible to aim the ball when you're hitting the outside of your boot, right?
Typically, if you send the ball straight into touch, that's what you've done.
Exactly. Like, you've just hit it completely wrong and the ball kind of bananas round.
Yeah.
Foy Dupree does this deliberately and it lands straight in JP Peterson's hands. And there's no way...
You can tell by his ball drop.
The trajectory, I watched that back as well, just to check.
Because Stuart Barnes questions whether it's deliberate.
Yeah.
And I thought It's got to be. It's got to be.
Yeah.
If it was anybody else, I'd be questioning it. But you look on the replay, like, he very deliberately drops the ball onto the outside of his right boot, which is horrendously risky and so skillful. Carry on. Sorry.
Yeah, so it's one of the most unbelievable bits of skill you'll ever see. Yeah, he drops onto the outside of his boot, which should be impossible. And because I've never seen someone do a cross kick like that deliberately, none of the lines are kind of expecting the trajectory it takes. Because it looks like a mistake. Like,
he's shaping for the corner,
like,
isn't he?
Yeah. If someone kicks like that, it's normally a mistake.
If I was stood in Luke Fitzgerald's position there, right, and I see Freud Dupre shaping the kick, I would turn my shoulders and run for the corner flag.
Yeah, exactly.
Thinking that's where the ball's going.
Yeah, you're looking at the touchline, definitely. You know, I'd head over the touchline and wait for it to come and try and, you know, run back in from there. Whereas instead, it goes straight into GPP's hands and the Springboks get an attack out of it.
Does another inch perfect kick and forces Fitzgerald back for a scrum five, basically.
Yeah. Miles Harrison says, look, we've talked about Miles Harrison and his wonders as a commentator a lot in the past.
Yeah, love that guy.
He says one of the most bizarre things of his commentary career about Fory Dupria, about this time. Fory Dupria, the man with cat-like qualities.
Yes! He described him as feline in the second half.
He never explains what he means by cat-like qualities. Yeah. And then again in the second half, he says, once again showing his feline qualities.
I quite like that as a thing, though.
Is that because before putting the ball into a scrum, he always drinks a saucer of milk?
I always assumed it was because he has nine lives.
No, yeah.
And he wears nine on his back.
He loves iams.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think he plays scrum half because he's so used to chasing balls of wool and he just likes having the ball there all the time?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what the Lions should have done in that second half, right? Because he didn't have a scrum half on the bench. They should have just got a laser pointer in the stadium and just shown it on the ground and he would have chased it out of the ground with a laser and just sent him into like a nearby river and waited.
That would have been great because that either would have disproven Miles Harrison's point or the Lions would have won the game.
Yeah.
Win-win situation. You've got one over the greatest rugby commentator of all time, or you win.
Sorry, Bob McLaren.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's also around this time as well, Brian Habana makes an incredible intercept on a great Lions attack, like really well read. And, right, normally you'd look at that and go, one intercept by Habana, but you go, what? Like, the great read in that situation is Tommy Bowe to read that Habana's going to intercept it.
Yeah, and he just blocks him. Yeah, like as he's catching the ball, he makes a try-saving tackle.
If anyone else is on that wing, Habana scores.
Yeah.
Because he reads it perfectly. But Bowe is such a good winger himself that he reads that Habana is going for it, is going to beat him to the ball and gets into position to make the tackle instead of bothering about the ball at all.
Yeah. So the South Africa get a penalty out of that and Francois Steyn goes from 50 yards and narrowly misses. So the score is 13-5 at this point. Forgot to mention Ruin Pienaar missed the conversion of Peterson's
try. Ruin Pienaar missed right next to the post.
So yeah, it's 13-5 to the Lions at this point. When
and the
Francois
Lions
Steyn
have now got on top in the scrum as well.
That's very important. That Adam Jones kind of tames the beast for a little bit.
Yeah.
Which is so unexpected.
There's a few scrums that I think nowadays the team would absolutely leave in and milk a penalty. And they just played them out there. Because we were kind of in the early days of teams going for scrum penalties as a tactic.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Kind of only caught on a couple of years before that, before this.
Yeah. It was one of those things that hadn't quite been mastered, wasn't it? And now we're sort of going back out of that trend because people tend to go for a line-out even in when their penalty's in midfield a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that is an interesting thing, the science of scrum penalties. Or even, I suppose, tap penalties people are going for now, I suppose. But yeah, no, you're right. But when Adam Jones first won a penalty over the Beast, it was like, oh, that's what that feels like.
Adam Jones in the week had been asked about the Beast and if he was worried about facing him after what he did to Phil Vickery. And he, in that very Adam Jones way, just went, no, not really. And then they kind of asked him, like, oh, do you want to elaborate on that? He said, well, he's been playing tight end for 3 years. He's been elusive for 3 years. I've been playing tight end for 15 years. I'm not worried about anything he's going to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's been a number eight before that. And had converted,
of course.
You know, as a teenager.
Yeah. So there's a point where, J.P. Peterson nails Rob Carney after he's kicked the ball.
Yes.
Gets penalised for it. Carney attempts to drop goal from halfway just for Bantz.
I love this. right? It's never on. It's never going to come off. I know he gets one a few. I think it's the next time Leinster win the Heineken Cup.
Yeah, yeah. He got one against Claremont from 50 yards.
Similar position, right? I know he's got it in his locker. He was never going to get this. And I know it's at altitude as well, and he's got a big boot and everything.
Yeah,
he was never going to get this. But I want my fullback to be so high on confidence of everything having gone so well for him in the first 20 minutes that he goes, I can do a 50-metre drop goal. I can just get a drop goal from my own half. Yeah, who gives a shit?
There are times where I'd hate that, but I love from there because he had nothing to lose, it's not like he was going to stem a great counter-attack from there.
Yeah. If it was any other player on the team, if it was, even if Stephen Jones had like a 50-metre longer range than he does, or if it was Ronan Agar or anyone, you know, if it was Lee Byrne, who also had a huge boot, and I've seen hit drop goals from a long way, I would have been kind of frustrated by it. But it being this fullback who was having the game of his life, and he's so high on confidence, he just does it just to see if it will happen, you know, to see if I'm going to have like a 100% perfect game or a 99% perfect game.
Yeah.
And he instead, he misses it. But that's what I want my fullback doing. I want my fullback in that position, looking so baller that he's going for that.
I then have written down Catching Filth by Carney.
Yes.
Because he pulls off a few like insane catches where the ball is seemingly between his legs and he's still catching it. Like, oh man.
He's all-time AFL tribute package.
He is genuinely the greatest fullback under the high ball I've maybe ever seen. Like, he's certainly up there. Yeah. So Jamie Roberts
in the air catching the ball, isn't it?
You know? Ah, nice. Yeah. Jamie Roberts makes a really good read tackle on Pienaar, where he smothers him, opens up a gap for Brian O'Driscoll to make a breakdown turnover, and then the Lions get attacking opportunity. I just have Bod, what a pass to Luke Fitzgerald.
Oh,
so Bod
man.
Runs like an inward angle and manages to, without looking, flip the ball on the outside to Fitzgerald. So just give him acres of space. And like, space wasn't a thing that was really seen in this game, especially on the outside of JP Peterson, but Fitzgerald has acres there. Feeds it back inside to Bod, having drawn in the fullback. And Ruan Pienaar, man, like he works back like about 30 yards and manages to sprint to keep up with Bod and scythes him down on what was definitely a try scoring opportunity. Like when Fitzgerald had the ball, you thought, oh, they're definitely good, you know, they have to score here. But Pienaar cuts off that space in such an insane manner.
Ruan Pienaar has an interesting game because I think he's excellent in defence. Like there's a few moments of really, really good, smart defending. Yeah. He has a complete mare kicking wise, and he contributes very, very little with the ball.
One
point Stuart Barnes brings it up that he's just not sprinting onto the ball, he's just catching and then passing it on to someone else. Like he's not adding anything. There's no
which was kind of his way as a 10, you know? And that's not a bad thing as far as I'm concerned, but I think there were the game came to a point where they wanted that point of attack to change, you know?
Yes.
And obviously they did that, and obviously we'll come on to that. But you're right, Pienaar had a very up and down and middling game all at once.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you
get
why there was frustration with him.
Sure, yeah. So anyway, they carry on attacking. There's another point where... So they go back to the blind side where Fitzgerald's still on the left wing, and he has about... He has about 3 inches to work with. And Rob Carney somehow just holds the ball up and just pops it up to him perfectly and somehow draws in about 5 Springboks. So Fitzgerald makes another break.
Another moment of the opposition going, well, this guy's absolutely having one. This guy is on one. We're going to mark him. And he just flicks it to Fitzgerald. And I think it's the only pass he throws in the entire game.
But pretty
what
much.
What a pass to throw.
And then the Lions have a great string of attack. They go in field a little bit. I think at one point Phillips has a little snipe, which goes quite well. And then eventually, as soon as it stops looking like they're making significant yards, Stephen Jones just drops into the pocket and takes a drop goal. And I love that. Like, brilliant. That is a team high on confidence going, we're going to cash in, you know?
Yeah.
Bingo. And they take 3 points, go 16-5 up. What a great option that is. That's one of the most delightful drop goals you'll see.
I just wish more teams would do this. I don't know why this hasn't become a pretty exact science.
Yeah.
And I wonder
if it was as soon as you take a phase backwards, you know, you can cash in and take 3 points. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of teams like that, like the current Ireland team, for example.
Yeah.
They will always stick with an attack, especially like if they've got a penalty advantage or something.
Yeah.
And eventually something jammy might pay off for them and they'll get 5 points out the back of it. But the way Stephen Jones just goes, 3 points is a great result from this attack. We'll take it.
The other thing that you're losing is, you know, the kind of time and pressure and soak-up value of just having the ball and how difficult it is on an opposition, you know, to be making stress tackles constantly.
Yeah.
But, you know, I get that, and I get, you know, unless it's the last 3 minutes or so and you're already, you know, how many points ahead? 1 point up or something, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Is 3 points not more valuable, you know? At the end, it's not sure Sackles that win it. And I don't know, I love drop goals. I think drop goals should be more involved. And as anyone who has witnessed my Rugby Union Manager free save, where I took Nottingham to the Premiership, we survived our first season, finished 10th in the Premiership, and then I got fired despite building a squad, and it was hugely frustrating. But I did a lot of that on knowing when to press the button to say, make your team go for drop goals all the time now. You know, and when to be patient with that and wait for that and make that work. And I think that is most of the strategy in the game. Or at least it was for me. I'm now in charge of Munster, by the way. I got fired by Nottingham, and I'm now coaching Munster.
In real life, this is...
Yeah. We just had Antoine Dupont. And I decided to put the game to aside for a bit.
Cool. So, from the kickoff, Habana kills Tommy Bowe casually. Yep. And then, there's this persistent problem, right, with Mike Phillips, where he's never at the base of rucks.
No.
He is constantly either carrying the ball himself or getting too distracted by someone like Bakis Botha. And I think this is a big part of why the Springboks are so in this game, is because they nailed getting into Mike Phillips' head.
Mm.
And, like, Luke Fitzgerald was having to play about 30% of rucks at nine. Him or Tommy Bowe. Or Adam Jones. Adam Jones had a dive pass at one point. It's incredible.
This very ruck, so does Luke Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
Luke Fitzgerald goes for the... So he starts on his knees and then does a dive pass from there.
It's really uncomfortable,
isn't it?
It's
really a dive pass.
Yeah, yeah. So they go with a Fitzgerald 9, Roberts 10 halfback combination for this phase. And Jamie Roberts kicks the ball out on the full.
Yeah, it made me wonder why they haven't done this more often.
Yeah. So from inside is 22. Like, if one of those was the correct halfback, that wouldn't have happened.
No.
But instead, you've got Fitzgerald and Roberts, who both look so uncomfortable with the whole situation. And it's mental, because you never see that now. You would just see the winger just go, okay, I'm just going to take this in, wait for Phillips to get to his feet, and then we'll actually organise ourselves from there. But instead, Roberts kicks out in the full. Luckily, they get away with it. The Lions get a free kick from the line out. And then Franswell Stein gets... the chance to go for goal from an obstruction 55 metres out.
Where at the time, when it was given, I wondered why they weren't going down the line. Then I remember they changed the laws since then and they couldn't because an option because it was full time. Half time was gone. It was 40 minutes. It was up in the
Of course. So it was one of those where it's just like, well, we might as well go for it from here.
And first two games, Stain has been missing a Rodriguez level amount of long range shots.
Sure. But it's still terrifying every time he goes for one. Because he actually... The difference between him and someone like Rodriguez is Francois Steyn's meterage is probably about 65, 67 is probably his range. Martin Rodriguez was about 21.
Yes.
And he was attempting them from halfway.
Those also weren't played at altitude.
Yeah. And Martin Rodriguez is also crap. So, you know.
But there is something interesting about this era of Francois Steyn. Because much like Martin Rodriguez in that period... Franz Steyn has like a kind of like Parise Rico Ioane level ego to him at this stage of his career. You know, having become the youngest player to ever win a World Cup, having been drafted straight to play fullback for the Lions series, Franz Steyn has ego with everything he does. He's like, I'm the biggest guy, I'm the quickest guy, I can pass, I can kick the ball from 99 metres. Look at me, I'm so hot all the time. And it's exhausting to watch. And it leads to him drifting off and trying to make huge shots on a lot of players and letting people go by him, like Carney for the try, like Gethin Jenkins for the greatest moment of rugby of all time. And it's sort of, you know, he grew out of it, Franz Steyn, but he grew out of it by spending a lot of time in France being battered by fat second row.
Sure, and then still inexplicably nailing drop goals from the halfway line.
Yeah.
So he nails this kick and the Lions go in 16-8 up at halftime. And you think that is an amazing half by the Lions, you know, against this quality of opposition. Like, you will take any lead, let alone an 8-point lead. And it's at this point, it kind of felt like South Africa were lucky to be in the game, in a way, because the Lions were very much the team on top. I guess it's kind of the flip side of last week's game, you know, that the Lions didn't deserve to be really in it at all. And this time, the Springboks feel like the lucky team.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yes, the second half then kicks right off and very much continues as it previously was. Incredibly high spirit, stakes, everything.
Yeah, and skill level by Rob Carney.
Yes, Rob Carney covering every blade of grass.
Yeah, doing good kicks.
Determined to have no fun.
Yes.
I thought to myself, watching the first few minutes of that half, there is no way I would ever bring Martin Williams on for this game.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's so physical and violent that it wouldn't suit someone just being a cheeky little prick.
I was going to say, like, you want proper gruff shithousery rather than cheeky shithousery.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, never has a game suited Vincent Rattez less.
Yes. And never has a game made me go, you know what? Paul James would be great in this.
Yeah. Oh, why don't we bring on Jason Leonard?
Yeah. You know, in that way, Paul James wants just, when the referee wasn't looking, punch his opposite number out.
Yes!
And scrum.
Like, he was getting dominated by Perry Freshwater and then just decided, I'm having enough of this, and then just knocks him out.
Punched him in the face, then had his number for the rest of the game. Look, that's the guy I want. A, scrummaging for me, but B, serving my coffee.
Yeah, absolutely. Because he is, after all, a male Welsh ex-international rugby player.
Yes.
Therefore, he has a coffee shop. So the second half starts, as I say, Rob Carney puts in a really good kick. And then the box just start to really make ground efficiently, and you think, oh no, they're in this game. No, we don't like this. No,
stop attacking well. Top, don't they? Brian just
and the Lions start to panic.
But it's kind of forced, you know, that like they've opened them up a bit and Bod's forced to come in and smash someone. Yes, and then we get to the point, just after that tackle, where at the time, right, this stoppage lasts about 5.5 minutes, which was a really long stoppage in 2009, but was below average in 2021 because you have Brian O'Driscoll is down, Adam Jones is down, Geoffrey Jenkins is down.
And Jamie Roberts is down.
And Jamie Roberts is down. Jamie Roberts gets up first. He's the first one to say he's okay.
Yeah.
Geoffrey at this point has already gone off of blood once, and Andrew Sheridan's come on for him. And then, yeah, we're left in the situation where both Lions props have to go off at the same time in the 46th minute.
Yeah. So Adam Jones, it's horrible, the injury. So it's Backy's ball and nails him in a ruck, basically. Mm. And Adam Jones' shoulder is exposed and Backy's ball flies in. And it is legal, what Backy's ball does. It's horrible, but it's legal.
It's completely reckless, but it's not illegal. You know,
really look at it and try and find a way to penalise it, like as a Lions fan.
Yeah.
But you can't,
I think it's one of those where I understood the ban that he got for it.
Sure, because it opposed rugby values, of course.
Yes. So he was banned for it being a shoulder charge. South African rugby, and I'm sure you remember this, but it's, you know, again, this is part of the whole reason Twitter would have been so horrible.
Yeah.
Peter Deville is also after the game, after saying Berger's action shouldn't have been penalised, it was nothing in it, it shouldn't have been a yellow card or a penalty. Then went on to say that Backy, you know, when he was cited, said Backy's boat had done absolutely nothing wrong. And South African Rugby issued a statement saying that Botha's ban was a textbook clear out. And they launched an appeal after Botha was banned for 2 weeks for this. As you say, it's not a penalty, but it is dangerous.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, me sticking up for Botha a minute ago, I totally get why this is given, you know, because it is horrible to look at. And you can't help but feel like, in the best way possible, Backy's Borta was trying to hurt Adam Jones there, you know? Because it's Backy's Borta. It's what he was literally born to do on a rugby field was hurt people, you know? This one is maybe slightly more violent than a lot of the other ways Backy's Borta has hurt people on rugby pitches before. Because he's a big bastard, you know, Backy's Borta. And was the best at being that. He is, to this day, the one who is quoted as sort of the enforcer-type lock, the model of that.
Yeah.
And so in the Springboks' next match after the Lions tour... It was the third test, wasn't it? It was the third test. They came out with the Justice for Baki's armbands, didn't they?
Yes. Over the fact that, you know, he was banned unfairly, they felt. They'd already won the series, so who gives a shit? You know, and it's a pretty daft thing. You know what we said last week about Phil Vickery being a great lad?
Yeah.
Phil Vickery said before that third test, in the week between the second and third, that he shouldn't have been banned for it. And he thought it was silly. Adam Jones said after the tour, this is a quote, Botha shouldn't have been banned for it, nowhere near, I don't have any complaints. He just cleared me out the ruck and I got caught. Everyone counteracts nowadays, if anything, I was in the wrong place. He just hit me and I was unlucky.
Yeah.
Which I think it pretty much sums it up, as I say. It's reckless rather than anything else. I don't think there's anything in it. I went, again, checked it back live, you know, because you've obviously seen the other angle since, and I don't think there's a penalty.
I won't go around pretending Becky's Botha should have got sent off for this, you know.
No. But also, I wouldn't go around saying, just for Backies, this is so unfair, we're so hard done.
Agreed. That is a stretch too far.
Nowadays, there would have been an hour-long video by Jaakko Johan on why Backies Botha actually doesn't eat children, is a nice lad.
Yeah. Or maybe Jack John, the Lions equivalent, talking about how the referee has bottled it. You bottle us, Gerdos. So, anyway, Adam Jones goes off. This is the turning point. The Adam Jones, who has been, dare I say, tearing the beast a new one in the scrum, goes off. And
he has been
we know that
12 years on it.
He's our only hope here, Adam Jones, to get a penalty out of every single scrum. But instead, they have to go to uncontested scrums because both Lions props have gone off. So Alan Wynne-Jones has to come on as a makeshift prop. It's Simon Shaw who actually steps forward and goes to the front of the scrum. And you know what? That's correct. That's the way it should be. Simon Shaw should be playing as an uncontested tight head.
Yes.
And so the Lions have a bit of a reshuffle. They neglect Ross Ford as an actual front rower and bring on Alan Wynne instead. And you know what? Yeah, fair play to Simon Shaw for stepping up. So uncontested scrums. So no more penalties for either team off the back of it.
Yeah. You also end up in the situation where when I was watching this game back, the skip 10 seconds button is often quite useful in stoppages. And suddenly you realise you're skipping the entire scrum because uncontested scrums
quicker. It's, like the amount of times I like, you know, when you look down at your phone or whatever and you realise players already started because the referee just kind of goes, all right, on you go, rather than crouch, bind, set
and the ball
or whatever.
Just goes in. They also, the Lions, move Tom Croft to number 8 once he goes to uncontested.
Oh, really?
Rather than Jamie Heaslip. Yeah, yeah.
Clock that.
I can't tell you why, you know, but
a
couple of carries and so on.
I'll have to think about that very deeply. Yes, about that, because I know, having played at amateur second team level, I know that there is a science to how you adapt to uncontested scrums, you know, and putting somebody at number 8. And like watching the Bermuda Classic a couple of years ago, I clocked that Italy played Martin Cacciagiovanni as a number 8 because scrums are uncontested, you know?
Right.
Because he's a big lad who can, he can't, he's not got pace, but he's got a decent pop pass on him, you know?
And
when you're playing at a level with uncontested scrums, they're kind of the skills you need as a number 8. So, yeah, that's interesting.
Key attributes for a number 8, right? Big carrier, able to control the ball at the back of a scrum, has been partying with supermodels in Ibiza for the last 3 years since he retired from rugby.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't clocked that about Tom Croft, but yeah. So, Matthew Rees does a high tackle. There's a thing.
Yes.
And
that, as I say, like it's properly grabs him by the throat, throws him at the floor, would be a nailed on red
with
card.
With force.
And a long ban.
Yeah, like, with a lot of force. He tries to rip his head off.
Again, that's Matthew like Rees a 3-4 month ban at this point.
Matthew Rees spares him in the end.
Yes.
But yeah, that's pretty bad. There's a point where Simon Shaw is caught offside. So there's a charge down that Andrew Sheridan makes. Shaw is offside. He's in front of the charge down. And then sort of casually toes the ball on, thinking, has the referee seen me here? And then eventually, so I think it's Peterson slips over. And Shaw just sees the ball in front of him and she thinks, I'm just going to commit to this penalty and just boots it to the try line and gets penalised. Having like gingerly walked towards the ball, wondering whether or not to commit to this penalty. And eventually he just goes, you know what? Just get that penalty against my name.
Should we talk about Simon Shaw?
Let's do it. He's class, isn't he?
So, yeah, Simon Shaw, the oldest man to ever make his debut for the Lions, 35 years of age, older than Alan Wynne-Jones is now.
Yeah.
This was Simon Shaw playing his first test for the Lions.
Yeah.
Obviously, having been on the Lions tour 12 years early to South Africa as well in 97.
Mm-hmm.
Simon Shaw, in this game, is a bit like, You know when like you're coming towards the end of your phone's life cycle before you place it, before you get an upgrade or something.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And the charge is starting to go on it, right? And
yeah.
It still works, but you charge it. You put it into charge, right? It charges to 100% in like 3 minutes, right?
Yeah.
But then it runs out of steam really quickly, like after, you know,
sure.
10 minutes of YouTube videos.
Right? Yeah.
That is Simon Shaw in this game. Simon Shaw is... He will do this like unbelievable second row shit, you know? Like he will do literally everything you want. He'll make that incredible carry in the lead up to the Rob Carney try. He'll make a charge down a few minutes later after that. He'll, you know, take basically every line out the Lions need. He'll, you know...
Every kickoff, everything.
Yeah,
basically,
yeah, yeah.
In this game, Simon Shaw did all of the good stuff that you wouldn't feel the need to bring up on a podcast where you're covering the game 12
yes.
years later.
Exactly, which is the problem with it, right? Simon Shaw would do literally be everywhere. Like, I started doing this after a while, of any time the game isn't, like, a close-up of the crowd or something,
mm-hmm.
looking to see if there were any frames where you couldn't spot Simon Shaw on screen. And I think there was, like, two in the time I was doing that. I think there
sure.
was, like, once a winger made a break, and that was the only time you couldn't see Simon Shaw on screen.
Sure, yeah.
Like, he was absolutely everywhere. He would then, at the next stoppage, fall on the floor in a heap. And, like, he would always look knackered. Then the moment the referee blew the whistle back on, he would, having, like, recharged fully in the space of those kind of, like, 40 seconds out, he would get back up and do it all again.
Yeah.
He was unbelievable. But also, you feel like he probably couldn't have gone if they didn't have a handful of stoppages every so often.
Sure.
I know Simon Shaw in this game was the first time Stephen Jones, the idiot Stephen Jones, not the fly-off Stephen Jones, that, you mm-hmm. know, oh, I've got a billion awards and I've, you know, da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, he's blocked me on Twitter. I can just refer to him as the idiot Stephen Jones.
Yeah, Stephen Jones.
Sorry, that's how I should have referred to him. This was the first time he ever gave a 10 in player ratings with Simon Shaw in this game. And I don't think I can disagree with that much. When I said there's another player I think has the best game of their career, I think Simon Shaw has the best game of his life in this game.
Yeah. There's a really touching interview that Graeme Simmons does with him after the game. Mm. I think we'll cover that later on. But yeah, you know the one I want about.
No, let's do it now. Let's do it now.
Okay. So it's a really poignant moment. So
yeah.
Simon Shaw, let's spoil it. He's the official man of the match in this game.
Yeah.
Because he works his socks off in his first Lions test. You can tell how much it means to him, this being 12 years in the making. Mm. And... he is so dejected in the post-match interview that Graeme Simmons is really trying to lift his spirits. And Graeme Simmons is asking really good questions, like trying to engage him. And Simon Shaw just can't give answers. Like, he's trying to be decent about it, but he just kind of says, like, I'm not a Lions Test Series winner. You know, that's all that matters to me.
He's completely emotionally and physically spent.
Like, yeah.
That is a man who was given absolutely everything he has, as I said, both physically and emotionally, and lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
His first question is, you know, Simmons' first question is something like, you know, they say big boys don't cry, but do you feel like it right now? And Shaw goes, yeah, I kind of do.
Yeah.
and he's trying not to cry. Yeah.
At the end of the interview, he does let a tear out, bless him. And Graeme Simmons says, Shawsy, I know that you said you don't care about playing well as long as you win. I've seen you play a lot of games for Wasps, big Heineken Cup matches, and I've seen you play a lot of time for England. That is by far the best game I've ever seen you play. Which is quite a spine-tingling moment to hear Simmons saying that.
And to his face.
Simon Shaw's response, and I have this written down, was, I just would have liked to have won.
It's heartbreaking, isn't it?
And then Graeme Simmons goes in for a really awkward hug.
Yeah, which almost, like, I get it from Simmons' point of view. But Shaw is not into that.
Yeah. I'm aware that we've spoken about that midway through the second half when we've not actually revealed the thing of the game there. But basically, that was all a
result
of the game.
Australia win
there.
Somehow.
Yeah. This is all a big bit that Simon Shaw's
a
doing.
A big cool bit.
To try and, like, piss off the South Africans by pretending that his team lost.
Imagine that. That's the Lions' tactic that they worked out in advance. Ian
pretend
McGee
you've lost.
Scribbled on a whiteboard somewhere. That was
I would
probably
love to
Clive,
see a
that
team
was Clive
do
Woodward's
that.
Tactics in 2005, right? We're going to pretend that we've lost every test and every game have been the most useless and hateful Lions team in history. And then everyone will be so annoyed that the All Blacks just won't bother turning up for the third test and we'll win it.
Yeah.
What he did consider was that they will actually be the most hateful and stupid Lions team
of
all time.
Yeah, yeah. I think Clive Wood was Clive Wood, who has blocked me on Twitter, I will have you know. Clive Wood's tactic was probably just to analyze the not counting score before the game.
I mean, look, someday we'll come to 2005 and we'll both have a lot to say on Clive Woodward.
Do you think when Felipe Contepomi dropped that goal when his team were losing and thought it was the winning one, do you think that was what he was doing? He just went and then told all his mates that he slotted the winning drop goal? I got this really good hit of serotonin when I kicked the ball, it went through the post, and I was like, yes, we're winning. Ask no more questions.
Something we both worked out, right? If you do anything with confidence, people will just go with it. Right? Like, I am actually not very good at literally everything, right? But there are certain things I've learnt to pretend I have confidence in, like talking about rugby on this podcast.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
People as far as that goes, I can relate. Accept it, right? I go, yeah, well, if you look at it, the bloody Scotland are playing a 1-3-2-2. They don't know that I've just pulled three random numbers and tried to work out what they had up
to. I don't even know if they're numbers. Like, I don't know what they are.
I know that. I know that because I can count to six.
I do often have it when there's lovely people who will read my articles or listen to this podcast or whatever and go like, oh yeah, I like this guy. And I just think like, if only you knew how crap at rugby I really am.
Yes.
Like, if you ever saw me play, mate, you would not be saying that.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are people who've played touch with that listen to this podcast. There's one guy who commented once saying like, oh, thanks for helping me up off the ground when I played touch with you last week. And I'm like, oh no. Oh no! I didn't realise that was happening.
So
again, because
I had it a few months ago. I doubt he's listening, but I won't say his name. But one of my coaches sort of said like, "Oh, you're everywhere now, man. Like, fair play to you." And I was like, "Shit, he's seen like some of my stuff. Like, I hate that. Like, he's my coach. He is very aware of how crap at rugby I am. So he must look at that and just think like, oh, this guy's winging it, you know? Well, like, okay, and he's a professional rugby player as well. Like,
so
oh, man.
Someone who has worked as a coach to professional head coach team standard, right? To like Premiership, Pro 14, Top 14 standard recently in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Has previously messaged me to tell me how great my insight is as a, you know, whatever, and how like whatever. And I can't help but always feel that says more about you if you're thinking this guy is just watching it on TV.
Sure.
Like, I shouldn't be worried about, what's that guy teaching his team if I know enough that he's impressed by my insight?
And
not like Razzy Erasmus is like, oh, he's loosely starting to keep up with, you know, whatever we're doing.
Sure,
you know?
And I suppose that is part of what makes it good, you know? That, like, you know, what you do is you kind of bring it to the level of the casual audience, you know? And that's why you've done well out of it. But you're right that sometimes when there's, because like we're guys who watch rugby, you know.
I don't think it's just imposter syndrome. Like, I genuinely, and maybe this is, you know.
Yeah, no. Like,
podcast, but
this sounds like I'm dissing you, but I agree with you.
No, because I completely agree. Like, I don't feel like I should be in the
and I'm in the same boat,
you
know.
Maybe an expert in terms of the fact that like I remember about games that, you know, the Scarlets played in 2009 or whatever.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
But
like, when I
got memories of Joe Adua.
When I listen to professional rugby players talk to each other, it's a different language. Like,
yes.
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah, we should probably stop exposing how bad at our jobs we secretly are.
Yeah, I hope no one listens to this.
Yeah, me too.
We definitely not put this out as a podcast.
Where were we in terms of the game? It feels like a while since we last spoke about that.
Simon Shaw, we're talking about Simon Shaw.
Oh yeah, he's good. Anyway.
So, yeah, we also start to see more of the... we start to see more and more of AB Jacobs. Like, he really grows into the game as he goes.
He does, doesn't he? Yeah, he throws some really good passes.
He even played.
Yeah.
He plays very well in the second half.
Yeah. He throws a few nice little passes. And he did that thing of being a bit of a foil, knowing he has basically the two fastest wingers in the world outside him, and giving them as much time as possible. And he played well, and then he actually stays on for the full 80, doesn't he? So it's de Villiers that they bring off for him. Yeah.
You've got Brian O'Driscoll and Carney start to slot in his extra kicking options.
O'Driscoll cooks
increasingly
well
in the second half.
Yeah.
O'Driscoll does. O'Driscoll's another good game. Not to the tier of phenomenalness he was the previous week, but very good game. It's interesting.
There's a point where I've written down 56 minutes. Lads, stop kicking to contest with Rob Carney. He's dope. Like, there's a point. Surely there comes a point where you think, let's try and kick it behind Carney rather than let's put him up for a contest with JP Peterson, because Carney has won literally every single one. Like
every
Carney,
single one. Every single
yeah,
one.
And like that's not an exaggeration.
High ball he goes up for.
Yeah,
and there are high balls that like Luke Fitzgerald or Tommy Bowe are going for that Carney wins anyway.
Yes,
like, he just sort of materializes and takes it.
Yeah, there's one where literally Carney is not in the frame. And there's two South Africans and two Lions jumping for a ball. And Carney leaps in from off the screen, takes it, does a 180, like, horizontally, and still comes up with the ball. And Stuart Barnes makes a hella involuntary noise.
Yes, he does. It's really quite insightful into him and Miles Harrison's private life. So, yes, I know exactly what I'm feeling and I stand by it. So, yeah, so there's a
I ship Barnes and Marison,
of...
Harrison.
Mate, I absolutely do. What a big cool pairing they'd make. So there's an awful lot starting to go the Springboks' way. Bismarck Duplessis makes a couple of turnovers.
Yeah.
He then, after the Springboks win a really crucial penalty about 30 metres out, which would be very kickable, he also goes for a stupid quick tap. But, you know, no one's perfect. He also plays 80 minutes, so fair play to him.
Yeah.
The Springboks, the only two substitutions they don't make are Carsons and Ralapele when they change their bench up to go 5-2.
That's interesting.
And then they don't bring either of the front rows on. But there we go. But yeah, so this is the game is starting to become more level after there's two quite interesting things happen about the same time. One is they bring on, at the same time, Mornay Steyn and Jacques Ferry. Rowan Pienaar and John de Villiers, as we mentioned, go off. A lot was made of the fact this was Mornay Steyn's home ground. He had previously in the season... Obviously, the Bulls went on to win Super Rugby this year, and Steyn had been the key player, you know, the player of the season for them. He had in the semi-final against the Crusaders, who were the previous year's champion of Super Rugby, and kind of, you know, the dominant team, the Dan Carter, Richie McCaw, Kieran Reid era Crusaders. He had dropped four goals in the semi-final, and, you know, that was described as the match of the season by Miles Harrison, not realising this would be a game that we talked about for probably 20 years that he was commenting on at the time.
Yeah, yeah. So, he comes on just after Stephen Jones gets a penalty, and go, they go 19-8 up. So they've got a lead to chase here, like a significant one. And so this is there's then the point that you discussed earlier where Brian O'Driscoll puts that tackle on Darnie Rousseau, which makes both of their heads spin. And then...
Darren Morris's head already spinning.
Yeah, of course. And then Heinrich Rousseau comes on as well. And like...
Yeah.
To do a little bit of a spoiler, Heinrich Rousseau playing 20 minutes is in man of the match contention for me. He is insanely good. He is just, because of how many sort of breaks away from international rugby he had, he is kind of by proxy one of the most underrated flankers in the history of international rugby. Like, he is an insanely good bastard of a player. Like, he is nasty.
Heinrich Brousseau seemed to only play when it really, really counted.
Yeah, you know? Right?
Like, he only played the huge games and he always stepped right up to them. Again, yeah. This was, what, his third cap?
Third cap, and he's just relentlessly world-class. And he just looks like a mega prick, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Like, he's in the best way possible.
He's got the face of if you try to mould a prick out of clay.
Yeah, exactly. Because, like, he is so scary to look at. Like, even just facially, he is terrifying. And that's before you look at him making tackles and turnovers. Oh, man. I could wax lyrical about him for a long time again. I'm repeating myself a lot here.
I'm just going to pick up the point I just made, right? Most of Heinrich Brousseau's caps came in 2009. He won, he won almost about half of his caps in 2009.
Wow.
So that was the only year where he played consistently every single game. He then disappeared for two games, played in the Rugby Championship and the World Cup in 2011. Was extremely good in both of those. Makes that chip over the top as well.
Yeah, of course.
And then disappears from international rugby for 4 years and is recalled... to play again, play in the World Cup that year.
Right, okay.
So, as I said, he just pulled it out for the big moments. You know, he only turned up and played in huge games. You know, played in big win over New Zealand.
He was invaluable,
a bunch
man.
Stuff.
Didn't it start? He never lost against the All Blacks.
Yeah, so he played the All Blacks five times, won four.
Oh, okay, yeah. Was
the
last
time
one
he
played?
That semi-final.
Right.
It was the only time he ever lost to them.
I see. I can remember that stat being thrown up around the time. Yeah. Oh, man. What a player. What a player. I'm going to talk a lot more about him. This is just us getting started. So there's a point where the lines, I think, throw a line up not straight. And then I just write, oh, no, it's about to happen, isn't it? Because they set for an uncontested scrum. And I think I recognise this.
Yeah.
Thora de Pria takes the ball up, and it's a very similar move to the one they did with the JP Peterson try. Jacques Ferry's line is impeccable, and the timing on absolutely everybody's running here is perfect. Brian Habana goes perfectly into a gap, and that's game over. Like, Brian Habana getting an inch of space in this match is all that is needed for him to just find a way to the try line, and he does.
When you watch it in context with seeing Habana go through behind him, it looks like Jamie Roberts makes a huge error. But then when you watch it back, he hasn't. You know, his decision is off by an inch.
Yeah.
And normally,
same
that means nothing. You can make that back up.
Yeah, exactly.
But instead, it's a try. It's the difference between winning and losing the series.
There's nobody else you'd want in that position other than Habana, is there?
No. Very, very few other players are, you know, running that kind of line and then finishing it.
At that speed, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Roberts then also does that thing where after missing the tackle, he goes and starts holding his arm. And obviously he had injured it earlier and he then hurts it worse shortly afterwards. But he goes, I've got an injury, I've got an excuse. I am a doctor, no one will question me.
It always reminds me of Andrea Marcy once kicking the ball out on the full and pretending he had cramp. Which is
falling
incredible.
Down.
It's like, if you have cramp, you don't kick the ball.
No. He fell down on the floor and waited for the physio to come on and fix him. Then the moment the referee called time back on, he got back up and was like, yep, I'm fine now.
That is heroic shithousery.
Yeah.
I am so here exactly for that. Because
I hope, now that he's coaching Benetton, that is what he's teaching them.
Yeah, yeah.
If only Galbisi was still there.
Oh, I know, man. I know. But, you know. Big Jaden Hayward's gone as well. Gutted.
Yeah.
That's 2 weeks in a row he's come up.
They have signed Andreas Pretorius.
As in the ex-Wales
flanker. Andreas Pretorius. The fullback. The shit fullback. The shit massive fullback.
Oh,
Kutsia.
Andreas Kutsia.
Yes.
So they do still have
completely. Played in the Jacques Kutsia era was shit.
He was
but
like
massive.
The epitome of that era for me.
Yeah, exactly.
Him and Kortnal Skosan, who's now gone to like Premiership, I think.
I don't think I ever watched him play, you know, much in the Currie Cup, you know, the old game of Super Rugby. I never understood him as a player, right? And I'm sure we've got plenty of African listeners who will probably go, actually, he was brilliant, you know, for whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But to me, he was big and useless. He'll be a good signing for a team that loves Jaden Hayward so much.
Yeah, this is probably a narrow-minded assessment from me, but I first heard of him because he finished that try where Dylan Lays did the funny back offload thing. That was where I first heard of Andreas Kutsia. And I thought, oh, okay, that guy. I'll probably quite like him if he's finishing tries like that. Not that he did the hard work for that. And then he got into the Springboks team and just decided, you know what's not cool? Catching.
Yeah, stay safe, kids. Wear masks. So the Lions and Springboks continue some rugby. Yeah, so Habana scores.
Habana
that brings things level. They're back 15-9 to win it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
15-19 even.
Things are suddenly very, very interesting.
Brian O'Driscoll goes off injured.
O'Driscoll goes off injured.
Shane Williams comes on.
Paul O'Connell wins a massive turnover to save things.
That's after the quick tap, isn't it?
Yeah. However, Stephen Jones misses touch. And that's the that feels like the sliding doors moment. That feels an awful lot like if he hits touch there and they clear and they slow things down a bit, you know, they get back in the South African half, maybe they kick free, whatever. That feels a bit like they weathered the storm, but instead
it's a horrible moment because you've just witnessed Stephen Jones go for a really ballsy step and run in his own 22, which is unlike him. You know, you didn't usually see him go for those, which is why it paid off so much here. And it was a proper, like, risky moment. And you think, okay, he's on top of the world. He's going to do this. And he misses touch, as you say. And the South Africans get a penalty, which Mornay Steyn steps up to take. And he nails it.
I've got it written down as 64 minutes. I made a jot of this. It all feels very inevitable.
Yeah.
Like, it becomes horrible to watch.
It does,
becomes
doesn't it?
Like watching like an existentialist movie where you're just watching a man lose his life, you know?
Yeah, it is.
Like you're watching a film like Death Row or something.
Yeah.
It feels like it's playing out so slowly.
Yeah.
Partly because we know the result, but, you know, also, just like the way in which momentum has swung so completely from the first 20 minutes, which were entirely Lions, to now be, you know, it's gone from being like 99% Lions to it swung round to like 90% Springboks, right? Yeah. And it's not as comprehensive, which makes it worse. Yeah. You know, that there's still enough hope and the scoreboard is still on the Lions side for quite a while.
Yeah, it's still 18-19 at this point, and straight from the kickoff, yeah. Scott Berger shoots off offside from like in like an attacking opportunity, and they go 22-18 up, and it's a really easy penalty. You think, okay, we've got the 4-point cushion back. This is this is okay. We can live with this, you know. Even though they've lost both Roberts and O'Driscoll, O'Gara's on at 10. Stephen Jones having to play in centre with Tommy Bowe. It's incredibly mishmash. But
Martin Williams comes on. Me having previously said there's no way I could ever see Nugget coming on. Suddenly it suits him. Suddenly you need someone to do, be like a little ginger prick.
Because they're broken up like bits of play from time to time, and which I didn't remember or see coming.
And it's the it suddenly becomes the kind of game where it's going to swing on one moment, right? And it eventually swings on two moments.
Yeah.
But that's how it feels. And Martin Williams is the kind of guy who will pull out moments both in attack as that kind of link man role he'd like to play. But also, just in terms of, he will pull off a turnover that literally no other player in the history of rugby could pull off because it was illegal.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think that might happen at some point.
Yeah. And it's why I think
he does get away with an incredibly illegal turnover at some point, doesn't he? I think.
Yeah. He always says it's Martin Williams. Yeah. That's why Martin Williams should be. He's often forgotten. It's why he should always be in the conversation for the great open sides, because he is the most open side player. Right, I've never seen someone who made, even Richie McCaw didn't make as much of a career off being as much of a shithouse who just like cheated. Martin Williams' entire thing was knowing how to get away with cheating. Beyond the McCaws and the whoevers of the world.
Yeah. So you know who came up with a big moment in defence?
Hey,
Henri Brissot came up with a big turnover. And just like the Lions looked like, okay, we can get a bit more momentum back, why don't we? And he's just an animal, isn't he?
Instead
turns a good Lions attacking opportunity into a good Springbok attacking opportunity.
Yes, from there they get... it all becomes very, very depressing.
It does.
I kind of have almost no notes for the last 10 minutes because I didn't feel like I needed them. And I was just kind of sitting there staring at the screen, feeling my life slowly ebb out, as it must have done like tenfold in 2009. I think it's how I grew a beard. Just watching this game, I aged 20 years.
Yeah.
And suddenly had a full beard by the time the game was finished.
Yeah, I had mine. I think mine started, so I was what, 11, maybe 12 at the time. So I think mine was about 7 years old by this point, but still.
Yeah. No, I was, genuinely, Yeah, so I would have been, what, like year 9 or something. I could grow a visible moustache in year 8.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's... I think every single, like, male hormone I should be getting all goes into facial... into, like, hair production. Like, body hair production. So those are my only masculine qualities.
Should we talk more about your body hair?
Please, let's. Let's talk about my shoulders. No, let's talk about...
about Jacques Paul Ferry.
Let's talk about Jacques Ferry. Let's talk about Jacques Ferry, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the feet that are not in touch. So, yeah, this try took far less time than I thought it did.
Right?
It seems super easy. Feeling like it took 20 phases of back and forth, left and right.
It's the sort of try where you've gradually ground down your opposition and it's like, okay, we're just going to put it over here now. Whereas instead it was like three phases. Mornay Steyn just pulling the strings. Side.
Yeah.
And JP Peterson, great bit of handling under pressure to set Henrik Brissot of all people again free. Gives an early ball to Jacques Ferry and the rest is history. Like, yeah.
Let's say they just sort of work one phase to the other side. They then carry there for a bit and the Lions defence really condenses around the ruck. Like it really all convenes in one area. And then suddenly they've got massive numbers over.
Yeah.
And you can hear the fear in Miles Harrison's voice as it goes wide.
I know. Yeah. It is. And again, we said this last week, like Miles Harrison is the voice of all Lions fans, you know?
Yes.
There's that sense of dread that he brings was all of us at that point.
My favourite is there's a turnover about this point. I think it's Paul O'Connor's turnover, which, you know, huge turnover penalty by Paul O'Connor, by the captain. You know, he's screaming for it. And then Andrew Sheridan picks a fight with someone and Harrison goes, "Don't reverse it!"
Oh, you've got to love it. You've got to love it. So an insane show of strength from Jacques Ferry. He bumps off Ronan O'Gara, who makes a really poor attempt at getting him down, to be honest. And then he has to deal with, what, Tommy Bow and Mike Phillips, isn't it, in the corner.
Yeah.
And he manages to out-muscle them both and slams the ball down with everything he has.
And, like, Bow gives it a good go. Like, this is a good cover attempt by Bow that will put most players into touch.
Yeah.
Ferry is nowhere near the touchline. Well, he's near the touchline. But he is not going out, right?
Like, yeah. Lightly
he is
Mac.
Safe. Thank you. He is absolutely Fleabag. You know, he is any other BBC comedy from the last 15 years. And yeah, so he is safely in. It's a great finish. It does look like his foot goes into touch, but then you realise it's Heinrich Brosseau's boot.
Yeah, which is a really important thing. Because I was thinking, like, oh, so is this a controversial thing? Is it not true all along? And it's Miles Harrison points out that's Heinrich Brosseau's boot. Mm. And I go, oh, it is, isn't it? And it's an incredible finish. Just keep his feet in place.
Because it's the same TMO from the 2007 World Cup final.
Yeah, so it's Stuart Dickinson, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of England fans probably wanting to be furious.
Sure, yeah. So... did you hear the conversation between Lawrence and Burdos that follows this?
Yes. I'm going to get this up.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about it, or do you want me to get
it? Sure. So, again, we've established that Bryce Lawrence has clearly lost all respect for Christoph Burdos. And so he asks Christoph Burdos, I have this written down, is his foot in touch when he dives? And Christoph Burdos then just gets his earpiece in and says to the TMO, foot in touch and dives?
Yes.
And just repeats back a few words from that, clearly not understanding what question Bryce Lawrence has asked him, and just tried to phonetically repeat it. So clearly he doesn't know what he's actually asking. And it's the right decision. Jacques Ferry does obviously score the try. Yes. But it rings alarm bells. It's a major red flag when the referee is trying his best to understand his AR, when he clearly has no idea what he's asked.
Bryce Lawrence, after his initial burst and his initial kind of snarky comments, realises... yeah. I should really be refereeing this game.
Yeah.
And start stepping in all the time and trying to tell him what to do and tell him how to referee the match.
Yeah. Given the previous week, Christoph Burdos didn't know the protocol for a 22 dropout. Exactly. And Lawrence had to overrule him on that.
So here we are at the touch. Like, Burdos is about to go up to the TMO anyway. Lawrence runs over to him to have a word.
They are the world champions.
So he's about to talk anyway. Lawrence runs over and says, do you want to check touch and goal? You want to check this? Da, 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 da. It's about to happen anyway. But, you know, he wants to have a little word. And then, as you were discussing...
is there any reason why I can't award the try, therefore? Christoph, I have a decision. It's going to be a try. You may award a try.
May or what?
Yes, you may award a try. And you are going to hear...
the foot in touch as they die.
The biggest roar.
If the foot in touch is die, can you check?
Bryce Lawrence, number 3 down, who is not the ball carrier, his foot goes into touch.
Bryce Lawrence.
There is no clear evidence of the player carrying the ball with the foot going into touch. Okay. The television match official is Stuart Dickinson. Remember him for the World Cup final. 20 blue, who is not the ball carrier.
Yeah. Okay, great.
So, a few points there. One, he says 20 blue, not green.
Oh, yeah.
So, congratulations to Italy on winning the Lions series.
Yeah.
You also have, him, as you say, saying, foot is in touch, is the line, is...
he's phonetically trying to repeat what Lawrence has said to him. He doesn't understand the question. Yeah. And so I think when... and, like, you know, it feels like we're very much picking on the guy whose English isn't very good here.
Yeah.
But, which is kind of what we're doing, I'm afraid.
Did you know that Christoph Burdos' hovercraft is full of eels?
What?
Never mind.
Okay. I'm just going to oversee that. So, when Dickinson says to him, no, the foot's not in touch, that's fine, I kind of feel like Burdos is gambling by giving the try. Well, for all he knows, that could have been Dickinson saying, no, it's not a try, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And also, the referee in TMO and touch judge can't look at the screen at this point. So that's also what Lawrence has been doing.
The TMO can.
Yeah, TMO is not looking at the screen. TMO's got to go entirely off vibes and mime.
TMO has a hat which you can pick out of.
Yeah.
TMO plays Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Mo.
The TV director comes in and does charades as to whether or not it's a try, whether he's in touch.
Yeah.
He's not allowed to look at the screen.
And Fourie gets the luck of the draw, and the try is given. When I say the luck of the draw, I mean incredible, like superhuman stress.
Yeah. When Mornay Sane comes to kick the conversion, they instead, on screen, don't put the E on Mornay. They put the kind of like division sign.
Right. I put this. I was going to come to this on Dick of the Day, because they did this for the previous penalty as well.
Mm.
That it's a tick, isn't it? So the E on Mornay is a tick. So he's Morn Tick Stain. What I'll do is I'll get a screenshot of this and I'll put it on the tweet for the podcast. But yeah, like, what a bizarre thing. So I was going to come to this on Dick of the Day, and I'm glad you've brought this up. I'm glad you also noticed this, because that would have been a really hard thing to describe on my own.
Yes. Yeah, it's because it looks like that, like, maths equation thing where you put, like, a number on the other side and you divide the number on the other side by it.
I've forgotten what that's called.
That's what I read it as.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
It's maths, isn't it? As I said, I can only count to six.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this brings us through. Speaking of maths, speaking of me only knowing up to the number six, this brings it to 25-22.
Yeah.
And so the Lions suddenly are 3 points behind the conversion, meaning it's not a point. They can't win it with a kick.
Yeah.
And the Lions do get downfield, and they do win a penalty. And Paul O'Connor makes a really bold decision to go for goal.
From about 43 metres out, I would say.
In the first touch.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And he absolutely nails it. They go 25 all.
Yeah.
There's another point.
Great. So,
and he gives, like, Neil Jenkins hugs him afterwards, but Stephen Jones has this look of just steely focus on his face. Of just like, no, I can't celebrate.
We need another.
Yeah.
That's 76 minutes he kicks that.
So there's a point where South Africa kicked loosely to Shane Williams in the backfield. Mm. And you think, go on, Shane. And so Shane Williams, like, he shapes up as if he's going to run straight, and then he absolutely waltzes past Skulkberger. He absolutely skulls him with a step, goes past him with ease and such grace and balance, and you think, oh, Shane, I love you. And then before he can make any ground, Heinrich Brassard picks him up and nails him and puts him on his arse. And so by stepping Skulkberger in such a glorious way, he has just ran into the path of the hardest flanker in the world who has put him on his arse. Which in Dick of the Day contention itself.
It's the most beautiful way anyone's ever lost 3 metres.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. It was a moment of brilliance by Shane, followed by a moment of being too small by Shane.
Yes. Two teams then at 25-all slip into a bit of kick tennis. It slides, all goes a little bit 20-21.
Yeah.
Two teams kicking back and forth. Fourie Dupria pulls the moment that made me make the loudest noise. He dummies a kick, dummies a pass, and makes a break down the wing himself. I did not remember this, did not see this coming at all. Completely caught me off guard.
Made so little space.
Noise. And I also stubbed my toe whilst I was watching it as well. That was that noise.
Yeah.
It is a proper big cool moment. So he, runs down the wing, and they start to get the Springboks into the position where you think, oh, they can work for some points here. It doesn't happen. They lose the ball. Ronan Ogara's on at this point. You notice that and you think... I did think to myself whilst looking at this final play, like, I remember... You remember how the game finishes. I've forgotten how that penalty came to be awarded in a moment of having forgotten about rugby. And I something was like, he's the... What happened? And it slowly, as we got further and further along, started to set in more and more. So the Springboks spend a long time setting up and going through the phases and not making any ground, but they're sort of still within range, and they have both Staines stand just inside their own half back for the drop goal.
So eventually Francois promotes himself, and you think, okay, so Mornay is going to have to go from 50 here, and we know that he's got that boot, we've seen him kick that length. And this comes off, South Africa had made a nice break through Jacobs to get into the half, and you can tell their own thing about drop goal here. They're not thinking about going for another break. They're not thinking about going out wide, They're just thinking about Mornay Stain eventually when Francois promotes himself and acts as an extra guard and an extra forward. They go into the pocket. 79 minutes, 32 seconds. Mornay Stain's drop goal falls short of the line. Mm. So the ball bounces up and Rob Carney has it. He has a little run. He puts a kick brilliantly, perfectly, into the South African 22.
It's an incredible kick.
Just before the South African try line. but only to see that as the ball is bobbling on the floor, Mornay Steyn himself has worked back about 40 metres, picks up the ball, and spirals it perfectly back into the Lions 22 with, like, not really much of an angle. And that, for me, is the match-winning kick.
Yeah.
Mornay Steyn curling that from... Because Rob Kearney could not have done any better. The ball could maybe have bounced into touch for him, but...
When Kearney throws that or makes that kick, I couldn't work out how the Lions lose the game from there.
It didn't feel real. Like, it's a clip.
No.
The O'Gara thing is a clip we've all seen a million times before.
Yes.
But it didn't feel like it would fit into where we are in this test, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It felt like, how are we going to get to a point where that is what's happening? But Mornay Steyn replying with that kick.
Yeah, to describe it, like, it lands in the 22, bounces over the fullback's shoulder, and is about to go into touch when Steyn regathers it. Like, he is on the touchline about 5-10 metres from his own line.
It bounced very luckily for Steyn as well, you know? The ball bounced very nicely for him.
But the ball has already gone over every Springbok shoulder and put them at such a disadvantage with the chase coming up.
Such a pressurised situation for Steyn to be in.
It would have been Bo or someone chasing. Yeah, like, there is a lot of pressure on.
Mm-hmm.
And for Steyn to then get it back, as you say, into the 22 and manage to make up enough ground, I'm not sure who's back with him to, you know, put everyone onside, that it forces the kick to come back in reply from the Lions, is a remarkable and tiny moment of skill. Because Kearney has put them into a really dark corner there, and Steyn has crept their way back out incredibly quickly and incredibly nonchalantly. Second cap.
I was literally about to say that. Yeah. Second cap. And that is a moment of individual brilliance, which has turned one of the most high-pressure rugby matches in history on his second cap. That is what... I mean, like... It feels weird saying this about Mornay Steyn, but that is what a Springbok all-time great is.
Yes.
Is made of, you know, moments like that. So we all know what happens. So Ronan O'Gara.
That ball bounces there and you see it going towards O'Gara.
The clip we've seen starts.
I had this just complete existential dread set in.
Yeah.
Like, I just stood up and sort of walked to the back of my kitchen where I was watching it. And I almost couldn't watch. Like, I just... I think I screamed to myself, not this time. Like, don't do it this time, Ronan.
The voice of Sean Edwards screaming, kick it out, kick it out.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I could hear that in the back of my head. It wasn't on the clip, but it is imprinted on that moment. Ronan O'Gara sticks the ball in the air, and it goes into touch for full time, and the Lions draw 25. That's what I've written in my notes, so therefore that's what happens. No, he sticks the ball in the air. Fora de Pria goes up for it. Ronan O'Gara takes him in the air. It's a penalty 55 metres out from the Lions try line. And it's not O'Gara's finest moment. He is bandaged up pretty much. His head is pretty much held on with glue. I don't know if he couldn't see or what. I'm not really sure what was going through O'Gara's head. I know that these stupid moments happen on rugby field, you know. And that is one thing that people remember O'Gara for quite a lot, which is, again, a shame, because he's an excellent player. Yeah. And by all accounts, probably a good person. But...
Hey, did you know that some women do try to understand rugby, but they can't because they're...
Oh, Christ, O'Gara said that, didn't he? Never mind, he's a prick.
Ronan O'Gara once said.
Yeah, I forgot that. Never mind, he's a shit.
It was something that Tom Savage brought up on that first episode we did.
Yeah.
Where he mentioned that... You know, a lot of people always bring this tour up and O'Gara having the mare in that last 10 minutes when he was missing a lot of blood and bleeding and kind of probably concussed. Like, he probably wouldn't be allowed to play these days.
To be honest, you're probably right,
in that state. We'd have had
Harry Ellis on the 10.
We'd have had Ross Ford on the 10.
Yeah, oh, I hope so.
Which would have been a worthy delight.
Yeah. Genuinely, however, Shane Williams would have been playing fly half at that point. Yeah. Oh, no, Stephen
We didn't quite cover it. So, the Lions backline at this point is Mike Phillips at 9, right? Fine. But then Ronan O'Gara at 10, Tommy Bow at 12 with Stephen Jones at 13.
Yeah.
With Luke Fitzgerald and Shane Williams on the wings and Rob Kearney at fullback.
So basically, they originally put Tommy Bow at 12 because Jamie Robbs was injured. And so he needed to be further away from the contact so he could have some time to recover, basically. I think was the kind of logic behind that. Jamie Robbs then went off basically the next stoppage. Stephen Jones ended up... I think the logic then became... Tommy Bowe, you're a lot more comfortable in contact than Stephen Jones is, so we're just going to make you play like a first centre, you know, and take the ball up more. And Stephen Jones is just going to kind of play out the back.
Well, frankly.
He does a great job. Tommy Bowe plays better at centre than he did on the wing, almost. Like, he was fantastic in both positions. As you say, Tommy Bowe couldn't have done much more in this game. He was brilliant when he moved into the centres and did everything that was asked of him. But, let's just get to it. Mornay Steyn lines at the penalty from 55 yards.
About this, right, is a player on their second cap is lining up a penalty from their own half, right? But the thing you feel and the thing you felt at the time is dread. It's not, oh, is he going to get it?
It's inevitability,
isn't
it?
It's not what's coming next. Exactly. Yeah. It's that inevitability that you know it's going over, even though it should be a really difficult shot from a long way out by someone.
You have so much confidence that this world-class player is going to slot it.
Yep. Yep.
It's unbelievable. And the amount of times you've seen somebody, a young player, miss those kicks and go, oh, well, I kind of wasn't expecting him to, you know, maybe when he's older.
Yeah. Noel Oliseo earlier this season, you know, missing that winning kick and, you know, his teammates flooding around him.
Yeah.
All of that.
Yeah.
And no one blames them. No one blames them.
Absolutely not. But Mornay Steyn never had, like, sympathy wasn't something that you could give him, you know? Like, he was never a young, inexperienced player. He was just icy cold, slotted the penalty from 55 yards and broke Lions' hearts.
So, I am going to read you what Miles Harrison says as the two teams run out from the start of the game.
Okay.
This is his comments on the stadium itself, where it's taking place in Pretoria, I believe. He said, this is a ground where dreams are not just crushed, but turned into reoccurring nightmares. Okay? Yeah. This game finished with dreams not just being crushed, but crushed by Mornay Steyn kicking a late winner to win the Lions series in the 79th minute.
Yeah.
Where have we seen that one since?
Yeah, that's never
turned into
again.
Reoccurring nightmares.
Oh, man. Oh, Mornay.
Ever prescient.
He's good, isn't he? He's good at rugby.
Yeah. He makes such a difference, man.
Yeah.
He really, really turns things.
Yeah.
I feel like we've talked in circles a lot, but we haven't really talked about the Springboks that much.
Yeah, I suppose so, but
I think there's a lot of... Like, I think Victor Matfield is incredible throughout this game.
He is, yeah.
He plays phenomenally well. I think the full front row actually play... John Schmidt has a good game. Bismarck Duplessis has an excellent game. Aside from that,
he does. Yeah, yeah.
PSP's grows with the game as it goes on.
Yeah.
And Foy Dupria is still one of the best rugby players I've ever seen.
Yeah.
He's just...
We can transition this into picking a man of the match, can't we?
Yes, that's what I think I was going to do. So, should we go into man of the match?
So, you go first.
I think Victor Matfield has a phenomenal game, as I just said. I think Foy Dupria is probably the Springboks' best player. I think his level of kind of tactical awareness is consistently really, really excellent. And there's a few moments like that kick to Peterson, like that little step at the end where he just pulls things that you can't see coming.
Yeah.
And every decision he makes is basically spot on.
Yeah.
I think he's good as...
He's flawless.
The best there is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think Stephen Jones has a really
excellent
game.
He's great, isn't he? Yeah.
Stephen Jones is fantastic here. And I also think, right, we haven't mentioned him. I don't think we mentioned his name once in either episode. David Wallace is really,
he's
really
great,
good.
Isn't he? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
David Wallace plays very, very well.
He was on very good
form. He sits down on the bench, and I thought, that man does not look like a rugby player. He looks like he manages a warehouse where you go to get car parts somewhere in, like, the West Midlands.
Sure.
But no, you know, it turns out he's an international quality flanker and a very, very good one at that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you mentioned both props and Matthew Rhys plays 80 minutes as well. Both props are very good. Luke Fitzgerald has a better game than I remembered as well.
Yeah, he does play well. He has his moments, yeah.
But for me, man of the match is between two names and it's really, really difficult to pick between Simon Shaw and Rob Kearney. Because I think both of them, as I said earlier, they both had very long, very celebrated, very decorated careers.
Yeah.
And I think this is the best either of them ever played in their career.
Yeah.
And it feels unfair to pick one of them. But I feel like I would be letting the team down as, you know, a one-time fullback myself if I didn't go for the one and only Mr. Robert Kearney.
Fair play. I have written down, I've got Adam Jones written down, I've got Victor Matfield written down. Foy Dupria is the reason why the Springboks win this game. Which is a difficult thing to see past. And I guess the likes of Mornay staying behind Brousseau off the bench as well, obviously, makes such a difference. But I also go down to the same thing as you with Shaw and Kearney. I think it's impossible to see past Kearney He's man of the match for me. I've spent this entire podcast talking about how great he was under the high ball and how good his kicking was. So Rob Carney can have his name up there with Doel Dimas as the tour's best players.
Yeah. I feel for Simon Shaw an awful lot that he hasn't got a single nod there.
Yeah.
Having the best game of his career. I want to just throw him like a sympathy vote, but I don't know if there's any point in that.
Yeah.
So, dick of the day. I mean,
so I've got a couple of honourable mentions.
Okay.
So one of them is the TV director for the Mourn Plus Stain thing, yes. Whatever it was. One of them is John Schmidt for giving away a really skillful penalty, where he plucks away he comes in from an offside position and plucks the ball out of the line side of the ruck one-handed, like with his fingertips, and gets penalised for it. Cool. And it's like, you know, it's pretty cool. There's a couple of times like he did one-handed pickups and stuff. It was quite cool. It's Christoph Berdos for me again. Like, he's again the dick of the day for me. And we've covered his discussions with Bryce Lawrence, both with the TMO, with the burger incident. There's a point where he tells Alan Wynne-Jones off in French.
Alan Wynne-Jones.
He had to be dick of the day for me. Like, he forgot that he was refereeing two English-speaking nations in a referee that is ultimately refereed in English. And clearly he was struggling with speaking English. And so he just decided to revert to French at one point. And Alan Wynne-Jones was offside from a kick. And so he told him off in French. He's dick of the day.
I thought Alan Wynne-Jones was very good off the bench as well.
Oh, yeah, it was good.
We didn't mention him. I thought he was everywhere. Yeah. No, so I think, once again, it's a real two-horse race for dick of the day. Because I had Christoph Berdos nailed on for the entire game and pretty much the entire podcast. And then I remembered up Ronan Bloody O'Gara.
Oh, yeah!
And I don't think we can let him off scot-free here.
That's a really good point.
So
I just totally forgot about that.
Yep. So, far as I'm concerned, right, dick of the day is going to Ronan O'Gara, and I don't think I need to explain why.
Sure. Yeah. GG, good podcast. Wow.
So, yeah.
South Africa win the series 2-0. Oh,
right,
not 2-0.
Yeah, South Africa have won the series. The thing is tied up. The Lions look dejected. Paul O'Connell looks deflated.
Yeah.
Simon Shaw, as we discussed, is heartbroken. He mentions in the change room, no one's talking. Yeah. No one talks at all. You know, McGeeken apparently says something about you can still be proud of this. But, you know, it's a very, like, Uncle Geach thing to say.
Sure, yeah. And they should, you know, they gave everything.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, one of the best Lions test matches you'll ever see. If not the best.
Absolutely. Everyone floods on Mornay Steyn, who is, understandably, the hero of the 12-year period.
Yeah.
And then, hey, guess what? He will be again until his son does it next time.
Yeah. Oh, man. What a test series that is. It's deflating to even talk about at this point.
Yes.
But, yeah. Wow. I'm finished in terms of words.
So good. So am I, apparently.
Mm.
Okay. So there is a third test. They do go on and play it anyway, despite the series being decided.
And it is a good test. Like, it's good value. So, you know, we're going to cover that.
Yes, we are. We'll pick up there next week. We will see you then for a test that Christoph Berdos is not involved in.
Yes. Goodbye.
Thank you, everybody. I hope you're having a very wonderful week, and we will see you in the next week, which I hope will also be very.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Bye.
Bye.